It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Greg Farrell from the Packet Pushers Network joins us, along with Dan Patterson from CBS News, Seth Weintraub from 9 to 5. We've got a great panel. We'll talk about election hacking, Skip and Scoot, the Apple iPad event, and the passing of one of the greats in personal computing. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 689, recorded Sunday, October 21st, 2018. Nobody expects the Scooter Inquisition. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval if you're in the market to buy a home. Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. And by ZipRecruiter. Most job boards overwhelm you with tons of wrong resumes. Not smart. ZipRecruiter finds the right people for you and actively invites them to apply. Smart. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. From the founders of Carbonite comes the cloud storage technology that's disrupting the industry. See for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to Wasabi.com, click free trial, and use the offer code TWIT. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron makes cooking fun and easy. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's geeky news with Uber geeks. I've got Uber geeks in-house. Nobody's more Uber than the host of the Packet Pushers Network, Mr. Greg Farrow. Hello, Greg!
Hello, Leo. I'm glad to be back. I'm even alive and kicking. It's 11:30 at night. It's great.
Oh, man. That's right. Well, we had to do this before summertime ended or something. I don't know. Has summertime ended where you are?
Yes. Oh, yes. Mid-October time frame.
You fell back already. End. Yeah. See, in the States, for some reason, we moved it to November.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of people who are complaining about daylight saving. They find it very confusing. That the time changes. And there's a substantial movement. It's a global movement, by the way. I don't know if you've been tracking
it. As it should be.
Yep.
It's ridiculous. We got to get rid of summertime. So
that's right.
There's actually
have to go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning.
In California, we're voting on that, but they got it all wrong. Proposition 7 says California will stay on daylight saving time. But that requires two-thirds vote of the state legislature and federal approval. Like, that's going to happen. So, like, why even bother? Why even bother?
I'm just looking forward to all the computer systems going tits up when the time changes.
Well, that's why they want to change, because Apple doesn't seem to be able to figure out. Again, the new Series 4 Apple Watch and watchOS, whatever it is, 5, it's not handling the change. Australia did it, changed a couple of weeks ago, and it's crashed Apple Watches. They were in boot loops. Apple's fix was, wait till tomorrow.
in 30 years of IT, we've had constant stream. I could, like, hundreds of times there's bugs around clock changes and daylight saving.
Doesn't seem right.
Yes.
Speaking of elections, we're thrilled to have Dan Patterson here. Dan is doing how many pieces? A 10-piece series on voter fraud. On what? On election technology.
Yeah, election hacking. So this is a 10-episode series. We are on week 8, I think, of election hacking. So we are examining, when I say we, this is for CBS News, at cbsnews.com/election hacking. So this is 10 stories as well as 10 produced segments, and then another 10 stories over in CNET about the mechanics of election hacking. And one thing we've learned is that 10 is certainly not enough. We will inevitably miss something that people, especially people in IT, look at us and go, well, what about this?
So we have in the U.S., we have what they call the midterms elections. They're coming up 2 weeks from Tuesday. So we're just about 2 weeks out. And a lot of alarm bells about election security. I will be listening to all of this at CBSNews.com. But what's just the top level take on this? Is the election going to be hacked?
It is quite likely that various actors will engage in different methods, different tactics of election hacking, but that is not to discourage you from voting. You should go and vote. So when I say tactics, we look at everything from voting machine hacking, because, you know, if you go to Black Hat or DEF CON every year, there is a voter village. Yeah. And we look at how vulnerable voting machines are. And they're incredibly vulnerable. As we know, they are simply computers, and all computers can be hacked. However, I had a great talk with IBM's space rogue, Chris Thomas, who is part of Loft Heavy Industries, a hacking collective. And he had a great thought, which was, look, yes, computers can be hacked, but one of the wonderful things about the American democracy is that we are decentralized. It is not a federal system. It's a statewide system, and every state does things a little differently. And that kind of security baked into the democratic process means that we have diversity in how we vote, or at least the mechanics of the technology involved in how we vote. And that's protected us from various forms of nefarious actors meddling with the election. Right now, it seems as though the biggest threat to election security is and will remain social media. It is influence campaigns that run.
Yeah, that's not hacking per se. That's attempting to influence voters, attempting to suppress voting, a variety of things like that. And yeah, that seems to work a lot better because you can be you can target a lot more people than trying to figure out which Diebold machine is used in Monroe County, Louisiana, so we can hack that one and change the vote there. But is that going to change anything in the state? It's a much more
cognitive hacking.
Yeah, cognitive hacking is a lot easier. If people are trying to hack voting machines, are these nation state? Are these governmental hackers?
Yeah, so attribution, the number one thing, if you talk to, and we spend a lot of time talking to Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Twitter, the large technology firms, as well as experts in cybersecurity, as well as people who actually run elections in various states, including Colorado, Georgia, Florida, and they will tell us that, first of all, attribution is incredibly difficult because the forensics take a long time to figure out, and
uh-oh, we've lost your audio. I think little lumbago has gotten a hold of your audio.
Yeah, and he can't hear us either.
Yeah, he's going on and on, and we can't hear a thing. thank you, Skype. That's honestly, Greg Farrow, the real threat here is not nation-state actors, but just the crap level of technology being used by everybody, including companies like Diebold.
I think it's complicated. I think what he was trying to get to is that there's more than one way an attack can happen. You can have an attack on the actual infrastructure itself, so the voting machines. But the point would be is that to actually do it to all voting machines across the U.S.
much more difficult.
To scale that attack is incredibly difficult and improbable. And to really impact the U.S. elections, you would need to be impacting a substantial number of people. Now, that's true, but the thing that strikes me about that particular discussion is in the current electoral environment, the left and the right is evenly balanced, right? And if you can swing 5 to 10% of the vote, you can actually get the outcome that you want by targeting certain areas. So,
you might say that's what we saw in the presidential election 2 years ago, because was a swing of 77,000 votes that turned the election.
Exactly. So if you could target,
but that's a national election. This is not a national election. This is at best statewide in 2018.
Yeah. Well, I think the election hacking per se that's been happening in the U.S. has much more been systemic. So we've seen various left and right wing parties gerrymandering the vote.
That kind of thing makes it very difficult.
That kind of thing, stacking the rolls with people from, this area gets zoned and there's and that's all white people.
Or voter suppression, making it harder for minorities to vote.
Cleaning the rolls, which just happens to clean out all of the people who come from left-leaning districts and so forth. Yeah. So I think, and now that's all That seems to be happening at very much more scale. So the articles that I've been reading about the US election system is the actual system inside the US is actually being compromised by the people inside the system. But they're using the threat of social media and the threat of election hacking to hide what they're doing. So if you can actually say,
It's not our fault. It's all those trolls on the troll farm on Twitter.
Yes, indeed. And so why wouldn't you blame them and point the finger at somebody else? But in fact, it was you that cleansed the rolls, which got rid of a lot of people in poorer counties who move a lot, and therefore they're suddenly not eligible to vote.
You know, in Dan, we're going to get Dan back. Something's gone wrong with his Skype. But in Dan's report on CBSN, CBSNews.com, there's an article that he's involved in called "These Are the Hackers Targeting the Midterm Election." He points out it's not just nation states, but multinational corporations like Cambridge Analytica. Are we seeing evidence that Brexit might have also been influenced? The Brexit vote in the UK might have been influenced? Because that's where you
are. Yeah, we certainly are. In fact, all across Europe, we're seeing the same thing happen in Italy, Spain, the German elections that came out. People aren't entirely sure even what happened there.
He points out Cambridge Analytica was involved in the 2013 Kenya elections. I mean, this has been going
everywhere.
On for 5 years at least.
Yes, I would think by this point that any data that Facebook has got has been stolen or take an unauthorized theft.
I mean, we know that.
And I don't think it was done by companies like Cambridge Analytica. It could easily, much more easily be done by employees, quite honestly. So one of the reasons that, the tech companies are very reluctant to say, oh, we'll control, we don't want to restrict data, we don't want to share it. One of the reasons that I'm coming to realize is companies like Google and Facebook, for them to put controls around the data is incredibly difficult. More importantly, it actually prevents them from functioning correctly. So they have things like a developer starts working on project A, they'll work it for 2 or 3 months until the project's finished, and then they go to project B. Well, project B might be on a completely different data system, but if you have controls on what data they can access, it might take them 3 months to get permissions and approvals and reviews. And so a lot of the reasons that they won't put controls on the data and enact privacy controls is because it would actually slow them down internally. And then the pace of innovation, or if you want to call it innovation, most of what Facebook and Google these days is copying each other or copying Instagram or Snapchat or, whatever somebody else is doing.
Hey, whatever it takes, man, whatever it takes.
Yeah, it's always called innovation, though, Leo. Yeah. It's always innovation, right? We did something new, innovation.
We have innovative ways of stealing the other guy's ideas. Some of the best.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
We spent a lot
of
time.
We're very good at innovating by stealing other people's ideas and copying them. Yeah, especially when they're doing better than us.
Actually, I thought this was interesting. Facebook has actually hired the former Deputy Prime Minister of England, Sir Nick Clegg, as their the head of global affairs and communications.
Now, this is a rather unusual. Now, Nick Clegg is something of a butt of many jokes here in the UK.
He's the Liberal Democrats Party.
And yeah, so which is now defunct, by the way, after his tenure as the leader. So
that'll tell you something.
Yeah, so about two or three elections ago, the Liberal Democrats came out of nowhere to be a centrist party. So there was a right wing, a left wing, and then the Liberal Democrats emerged to occupy the center. And then they sort of took a few votes, and then all of a sudden they got enough momentum, they had a really charismatic leader. And they were able to form an alliance with the right-wing party, the Tories, and then they were given the deputy prime ministership and so forth, and a number of various positions of power. And then they died. They weren't able to act. They didn't make any innovation. They didn't make anything change.
So he was the prototypical reformer who's beloved by the young people. Is that we're going to make things better? And then did nothing and lost the confidence of the voters.
Yes. And then after I lost the confidence of the voters abandoned them at the next general election, and the Liberal Democrats basically disbanded a couple of years later. So not exactly covered himself in glory here. This is not, your typical burning sprite arc of career glory. This is a man who was given the party after the head of the party stood down and then proceeded to run it into the ground. So I actually think this is great for me because I hate Facebook with a passion, and having somebody like this in charge of global policy should just be fantastic. I'm expecting it to blow up. I'm expecting Facebook
what
to
do you give him about 10 years to bring it down? It took him 10 years to kill the Liberal Democrats. I think it'll take him about that long to defeat Facebook.
I hope he does it a hell of a lot quicker.
Hugo Rifkin, who calls himself the funniest journalist in Britain, tweeted, "My timeline is intriguingly divided between people disappointed with Nick Clegg for going to work for Facebook and people disappointed with Facebook for hiring Nick Clegg."
I think it's great. Quite honestly, seeing Facebook.
Because you hate Facebook.
I mean, last week we saw the whole tech, the beginning of a tech clash. $200 billion was wiped off the NASDAQ as the Google, Facebook et al. All dropped sort of 5 to 10% as the investors go for the door. Because they definitely see that those companies are now under fire.
You think that's lasting? That's not profit-taking? That's not just a blip? That's actually going to be a lasting abandoning of tech?
Yes, I do. I think there's far too much stacking up against them. I mean, the European governments are now talking about mandatory taxation for companies like Facebook and Google. Like, Facebook paid $10 million in tax on $1.5 billion worth of revenue taken out of the country in the UK.
That's not right.
Right? So all the infrastructure, consumed all the infrastructure, all the employees. They don't even pay indirect taxation because they don't. The internet is untaxed. So there's going to be there's no reason for the governments not to attack Facebook and Google and Apple. And they're basically going to say, we're going to have to put a consumption tax on companies like yours. And it's going to take a few years because governments move slowly. And this sort of taxation can have unexpected impacts. So if you start to move to that, I mean, many governments move to services tax or goods taxes, you know, where you pay – like in the U.S.,
it's a value, state tax. You guys call it a value-added tax. A VAT.
We call it a value-added tax, but you call it state tax, right? So if you do,
well, we have sales tax, but that's a taxation on consumption. When you buy something, you pay 5 to 8% on consumption. But a VAT is a completely different idea. Tax?
No, it's a consumption.
It's tax. Consumption, but there is the idea of taxing production, taxing it all along the way. That is not what you guys are doing.
No, it's only taxed at point of sale. So
okay,
it's a 21%.
So it's a sales tax. It's a ridiculously high sales tax.
Yeah, those sales taxes work. What they do is they capture the black economy. Someone has to pay the sales tax at the final point of sale. So even if you're doing, under the table cash deals, you're still buying the goods. So if you're, let's say you're a carpenter and you're putting an extension on a house but you're getting paid cash, then when you buy the wood, you're paying sales tax. So some
Bill Gates... said a weird thing a few months ago where he said, well, you know, if robots take all our jobs, we should really tax robots. But in fact, what he was saying, I think, was smarter than that, was the notion that you should tax companies on production all along the line instead of, which is a much easier, simpler thing to do instead of taxing consumption at the end. I don't think it's as regressive either.
Well, the challenge here is that today we tax traditional companies on profit. So if the company doesn't make a profit, the company doesn't pay tax. And that helps to protect jobs and helps to protect the people employed there, because if you ask the company to pay tax and it's not making a profit, then people start to get unemployed, and that's bad for government and bad for society generally. Now, keep in mind here, my thesis would be is that a good capitalist should always remember that the job of capitalism is to keep people employed and fed and clothed. And that's why we have society.
What are you, nuts? The job of capitalism is to make as much money as you possibly can.
Yes. No, the job of capitalism was to make sure that people aren't on the streets shooting each other and stealing food from the stores
Right? So that we can make as much money as we possibly can.
That's right. And part of the value of capitalism is it has to be a redistribution from the top to the bottom. That's what taxation does.
You are a communist. That is not capitalism.
Actually, I'm a centrist, so don't curse me with a communist.
I really want to get Dan back in the conversation. We're having a little trouble with him technically. You know what I'm going to do is take a break and do an ad, and then we will come back because there's much more to say about this. In fact, Google has decided that in the face of regulation from the EU, they're going to hit back in the consumer's pockets, which I think is very interesting. That's one way to fight back on this. Now, I'd like to talk more about the tech lash. Greg Farrow is here. He is, somebody's saying in the chat room, a centrist only by the definition of the EU. Here in the United States, you'd be considered a leftist, lefty commie.
That's probably.
He is at the Packet Pushers Network and an expert in all things technology, especially networking. We're thrilled to have you. We will get Dan Patterson back. He's with the Tech Republic, where he's a senior writer there, and has in the midst of a 10-piece series on CBS News on election hacking, specifically what's going to be happening in a couple of weeks here in the United States. We'll get back to that in just a second. Right now, I want to talk about our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. If you're buying a house, you know there's some anxiety associated with writing that big check, the biggest check you'll ever write. And that's just the down payment. You're actually borrowing even more, you know, 70% more, 80% more. And that's, you know, plus you're buying something that you and your family are going to live in, that's going to be your home for some time. Rocket Mortgage comes from Quicken Loans, the largest lender in the country. They're the experts in mortgages, number one in customer satisfaction 8 years in a row. This is all according to J.D. Power, so this is, you know, independently rated that way. And one of the reasons they're so good, one of the reasons people like them so much, is because they're very customer-focused. That's why they created something called Rocket Mortgage, which really speaks to people like me, people like us. It's an entirely online mortgage approval process. I love that. That means you don't have to go to a bank. You don't have to fill out a lot of paperwork. You don't have to go to the attic and find pay stubs. They can do it all on your phone or on your computer. They call it the power buying process at rocketmortgage.com/twit2. There's three steps, actually. First step, answer a few simple questions. They'll check your credit, and you get pre-qualified approval. And all of that's just in a few minutes. Then the next step kicks in. They'll verify income, assets, and credit, and they'll do it within about 24 hours to give you verified approval. That's when you get that button that says print the letter. You can show it to your realtor. You can show it to the seller when you're making an offer on a home. You are basically a cash buyer. You're approved, baby. And that is important. I don't know what it's like in the rest of the world, but in the United States, it's really a seller's market. And when you come in as a buyer and you've already got the loan, that makes a huge difference. Moves you right to the front of the line. But that's not all. That's one way to take out the anxiety. But the third step, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. This really helps. Nowadays, interest rates are going up. And that means there is some anxiety, there's some pressure. Buy that house fast before they go up again. But you don't have to worry. With Rate Shield approval, Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It cannot go up for up to 3 months. If rates go up, doesn't matter. Your rate stays the same. Oh, if rates go down, your rate will drop. But either way, it's a victory for you, and it's the kind of thing you'd expect from America's best mortgage lender. Take the anxiety out of buying a new home. Go to rocketmortgage.com/twit to get your ducks in a row, as it were. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. But all you have to remember is rocketmortgage.com/twit and the number 2, twit 2. Dan Patterson is back. We've rebooted him.
Yeah. You know, every time we think Windows is stable, it gives me the
oh, man. Why do you use Windows? What is wrong with you? So you're now on the wrong microphone. You're on your headsets instead of on the Rode Podcaster, that nice Rode mic you have there.
Yeah, so I actually dual boot. I run a boot camp on my Mac. And I have an eGPU, and I run Windows so I can process things that simply, you know,
sometimes
Mac has turned.
Sometimes you just have to have Windows, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Which I'm not, you know, these days, I bet you Greg uses Windows. You use Windows, Greg? You must.
No, not in over a decade.
Well, I know Seth Weintraub doesn't. He's going to join us in about 20 minutes. I use Windows, but I'm using it right now. I'm using a Surface Studio. I think Microsoft's done a lot to make Windows 10 more reliable, although they've had some nasty problems lately with the latest
updates. I would point out that after 25 years of Microsoft producing an operating system, it still blows chunks. There's no hope it's ever going to work.
That's a technical term, ladies and gentlemen. we were talking about election hacking before we lost Dan, and we ended up talking about Nick Clegg running global, whatever it is, global
policy
at, at Facebook, which I thought was kind of interesting. But I do want to, now that we got you back, I do want to get back to the election hacking. There's some really interesting pieces here on this CBS News site. How AI is creating new threats to election security. Whoa. Artificial intelligence to target campaigns. How's that work?
So with every conversation in tech and IT, when we talk about AI, we go into the futuristic, very interesting Elon Musk world or the Nick Bostrom world. This is about automation and stuff that we think of as pretty almost rote or mundane. So automation is taking many of the phishing tactics that we saw in 2016. Of course, if you remember, John Podesta, the chairperson of the Clinton campaign, was phished, and many other members, I think there are almost 100, about 96 members of the Clinton campaign were phished in 2016. Automation is scaling that and creating. Look, if we think about a general election campaign, these are well-funded organizations that have the time, money, and really the human capital to spend defending the campaigns. But down ticket, and particularly during midterm elections here in the United States, these campaigns often lack those resources. So they are the targets of phishing, of email scams, and of other ways to infiltrate your accounts. Automation is creating exponentially larger threats because every campaign has valuable secrets and important information, and they just don't have the resources to defend themselves. So before Windows died on me, one thing I'd like to point out is that with every story that we do in this series, we discover more and more interesting little crevices that we could poke our head into. And there simply is so many vulnerabilities. As everyone who works in IT or security knows, every digital device and especially with the growth of the Internet of Things, everything is vulnerable. So it's impossible to cover everything. And what we wanted to do is cover the biggest threats to election security. And I think, once again, right before Windows died there, we were talking about influence campaigns and the role of the social web and cognitive hacking. We see state-sponsored cognitive hacking pop up in almost every country, or at least every powerful country.
For years, we've had advertising, which is a form of cognitive hacking. In fact, right now we're in the middle of the hottest season for TV ads for the election in California. And when you watch these ads, it almost feels like they're blatantly misrepresenting the subject. They're full of scare tactics. They're full of statements that aren't technically wrong, but are absolutely misstating the subject. And I'm sure this happens in every state. It's kind of mind-boggling. How is that different, this legal advertising? How is that different from the cognitive hacking you're talking about? It seems like it's just another blade of the same tool.
Scale, coordination, and intent. Look, the scale that we see with social media is much larger than television.
Really? Intent. More? You think more effective? Facebook's more effective than a TV ad?
Well, more people can access the internet and social media than access advertising on television. And you can certainly access groups and different clusters of individuals.
You could be more efficient, can't you? I mean, if you buy an ad on a football game on a Sunday afternoon, you're getting a vast audience. But with the Facebook, you can buy, I want to buy 35-year-old men in Mendocino County because I know that I can either convince them not to vote, which I think is really sleazy, or I can convince them to vote in another way.
Or you can repress votes.
Yeah, suppression is very effective, isn't it?
Yeah, Saudi Arabia has been running influence campaigns against and we're running influence campaigns against Khashoggi. And we now see the data that has popped up proving this. So when you
But they would just call that that's not he's not running for office. Obviously, he was a Washington Post columnist. They would just call that counter programming, right?
Yeah.
Khashoggi's saying one thing. We don't think that's true. So we're going to state our point of view and use social media to do so.
Yeah, according to the Times story, the Saudis hired individuals, humans, because on the flip side of automation, look, all of these companies, Facebook most notoriously repeats the line, we are going to hire 20,000 employees plus artificial intelligence to tamp down on these influence campaigs.
Yesterday, the New York Times published this story Troll Army and a Twitter insider in which they talk about the fact that the Saudis hired an employee of Twitter, basically just like you would hire a mole, a spy, a counterintelligence agent.
They suborned
an employee.
Yeah.
Twitter eventually fired him when they were told by American intelligence agencies what the Saudis were up to. But that's fascinating. Mm.
Well, they also hired humans, people inside Saudi Arabia. They paid them the equivalent of $3,000 American because they found that automation was tamping down on their attempts to run bots and trolls. So they hired humans to write Twitter content that was designed to repress or attack Khashoggi. Now, if we look at the indictment that came out on Friday from the DOJ, this was very explicit about not just the money and the humans who were involved. This involved oligarchs funneling money designed to repress groups here in the United States and inflame groups. This is directly from the indictment, but they pushed they tried to repress African-American voters. They tried to inflame voters around topics like the Colin Kaepernick issue, around Black Lives Matters. Around the burning of the American flag, around the issues of removing Confederate statues. You can take all
what
of
was
these
there,
issues.
This is the Saudis doing that?
No, this
was Russia.
The Russia in 2016.
And what was their goal in that? I mean, I don't.
Their goal was to repress voters or repress particular groups.
Especially African Americans, and say, well, yes, don't even bother to vote because it's hopeless.
Precisely. But you can scale this to or apply this to countries. We also see this happening in Myanmar. We see this happening in Eastern Europe. We see this happening with powerful nations like China. China is incredibly good at running influence campaigns. They find this to be almost as effective as we were saying earlier, targeting or hacking voting machines. The goal is to undermine faith and confidence in institutions and our American faith and confidence in each other. So if we wonder, why are we so inflamed? Why did social media all of a sudden become such a dumpster fire? Well, one big reason is us. We respond to these signals. And when you see that this is propaganda is a time-tested tactic, and when you see images over and over and over again, you are more inclined to be sympathetic or to have an emotional reaction as opposed to an intellectual or a slower reaction.
What is the defense against something like that, though? I mean, it seems like we're prime for this kind of influence.
Priming is the right word.
You know, one of the things we take a great pride in the United States is freedom of the press, freedom of speech, the right of everybody to talk. And that seems to open us up to any bad actor who wants to take advantage of that. Now we have social networks which amplify it dramatically in ways that we didn't really anticipate. But what do? You shut down Facebook?
I think
Facebook?
The flip side here is the algorithms in the networks have been polarizing. So a lot of the algorithms that we have in YouTube and Twitter and Facebook are driven by engagement. So if you click on something, then it uses very simple, very dumb things.
It works.
And that which is provocative, that which provokes outrage, gets clicked on, right? Even if it's idle curiosity or that bystander, I want to see the road. As you know, as you drive past a road accident, you can't help but look at it. And these algorithms don't have any
humans
discretionary.
Humans are so vulnerable to this stuff. We're basically little reaction, little Skinner boxes.
Yeah, that's right. And as you know, see,
we have no ability to fight this at all. So
no, and if it bleeds, it leads. You know, like if I can tell you a horrible story about election hacking in, you know, Missouri, I'm going to click on that and then be outraged.
This has been coming for a long time. That, you know, we've watched this happen on TV in the 60s, that this has been coming for a long time. And I feel like it's an oncoming freight train that nobody has any ability to stop.
And really has very little to do with any one particular election. Certainly has nothing to do with a partisan side. We saw evidence of bots propping up Bernie Sanders as much as Donald Trump during the 2016 election.
If your goal is to divide a country, then that's exactly what you do, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So no matter what side you may be on in whatever country you may be listening or watching this, this isn't about politics. This is about the use, a novel, a new use of the social web to spread misinformation. Yeah. And
that somebody who wants to be a bad actor and has enough money to do so, like Russia or Saudi Arabia, really can act in an almost unfettered way.
Mm. Yes,
and we're seeing this, the Democrats, both the Democrats and the Republicans in the U.S. and increasingly governments around the world are hiring and building specialist IT teams to produce those bots and to publish those articles, to blog and to cover them. And what we didn't see up until now is the mainstream politics taking action in its own right to own the ground that it covers. So, you know, they were out there using the press and doing face-to-face and walking down the streets. And other actors moved faster into new technologies and were hacking up Facebook, Twitter, and Google to get the results that they wanted, right? So now politics is catching up because it now knows that it has to react to that. And we saw I've seen various interviews with the Democrat IT and the Republican IT teams and just how effective they were.
Yeah, Greg, you're exactly right. And this really, again, has very little to do with politics. This is, we say cognitive hacking, but it could easily be called algorithmic hacking. And the issues are more important, or at least more diverse than simply a partisan issue on the right or the left, or even one particular election. If you think about the interests of not just state groups, but almost any group, information campaigns are a valuable asset in your arsenal. Yeah. And technology now has, when we all started, and certainly Leo and Greg, when you started, technology was far more of a vertical. Now it's a horizontal and impacts every component of life and culture. So it is not just about politics. It is about the power of technology and the influence and role of technology in life. And we really have to think about how we use technology, and the leaders of technology companies have to think of themselves as cultural arbiters as much as they are technological arbiters.
But if you go back in history and you look at when newspapers started in the early 1900s and when television started in the 1950s and 60s, exactly the same things happened. Everybody was hysterical about the fact that politicians were using the TV to reach out and publish ads. And that's why you have the disclaimers at the bottom of every political ad.
Yeah, but it was primitive. I mean, yes, at the time it was disruptive, but it was primitive compared to what people can do today.
And no, yes, but it's still primitive. What we're seeing with Facebook and Twitter worse. Is relatively primitive. No.
I think what you're arguing for is laws, is government restrictions, is regulations on this kind of stuff.
My point would be is that what we've seen is some fairly blunt and rather brutal sort of attempts to manipulate a population using a new tool before the system catches up. Okay,
correct.
That has happened. And now
you think the system will catch up, though?
I think we're seeing signs of it. So there,
I don't have any hope for that.
You know, we've got articles in the show running list today about Facebook setting up literally war rooms with people to try and get this under control.
But blaming Facebook or Twitter is not at all addressing the problem. Those are just tools.
But
if you have an actor
TV
who's willing to
before
use
that, we blamed radio.
Yeah, so that's
that
the point: is that it's the tools change constantly, and technology is giving them more and more impact. But that's going to never go away.
I'm not denigrating the effect, Leo. What I'm saying is that the system takes some time to catch up. It takes time for people to adapt to the new situation and be able to decipher what is false information and what is genuine information.
So you're bullish. You think people will figure it out and it'll stop having so much effect.
No, I think people are dumb, and it's going to take a good 5 to 10 years. And stupid. I mean, look at some of those political ads coming out of the deep south in the U.S. Those ads are obviously just full of misinformation, and those people are flat out lying. But, you know, they're still getting published onto television and no one's stopping them.
We're going to add a third voice to the mix. Seth Weintraub is here. Seth, it's great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Leo.
My pleasure. I let you sit and listen a little bit when you first got here, just so you knew the tenor of the conversation. Seth founded 9to5 Mac. He is, are you editor-in-chief at Electric?
Yep.
Publisher of both. Mm-hmm. He's kind of a legend in the blog community. And always a welcome voice in all this. Did you have any thoughts about what we've been talking about?
Yeah. So my, like, I don't know how deep you guys have gone into this, but my thing is always like, well, how intelligent are the politicians or people who are running the show right now?
But the problem to me, Seth, is it's not I think the politicians are the least of the problem. It's state actors in Saudi Arabia and Russia and the Philippines and Myanmar. Those are the problems, not so much the politicians. They're just riding on the wave.
Right. But somebody's got to make laws about. And right now the lawmakers, not politicians, but lawmakers, don't seem to really know what's going on. There's no real thinkers.
Well, there's space. I'll tell you what, though, there's an inequality because the people who benefit from this are then the ones who make the laws.
Right.
So it's like campaign finance reform. You're never going to have it because the people in charge are the ones who have benefited from a broken system.
Right. It's almost like having a media mogul get elected president of Italy, for instance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would never happen. Yeah.
Right.
Except it did.
Oh, yeah.
For those
right.
of you who don't know, that did happen. Just in case your sense of irony is suppressed.
Yeah. I'm glad that at least you, Greg, and maybe others on the panel are optimistic. I find it hard to be too optimistic about this.
I'm kind of with you, Leo. It's a little scary to me.
Yeah. How about you, Dan?
I'm optimistic about the fundamental tenets of democracy, and I'm optimistic about humans as optimists as well. We want the best. And,
yes,
and
I agree.
We see this is an anecdote you probably have heard or experienced a million times, but you can flame online pretty easily. If we look at Reddit or YouTube comments, it's pretty easy to see the flames. But when we talk to each other in person, it's a lot harder because we empathize with each other. And so my optimism comes from our humanity. I'm not particularly optimistic about our algorithmic future, at least in the short term. I think it will take more than policy. I empathize. I'm on every single one of these calls with Zuckerberg and Glaucher, and I empathize with them. Social media, many of us advocated in the early days as a democratization of the dissemination of information. But we have reached an inflection point where social media is potentially causing more harm than good. I think it is a cop out to point a finger and say that it is, you Zuckerberg or Jack, it's your fault. I do think that technology companies looked the other way. In fact, we saw Mark Zuckerberg say this in 2016. It's ridiculous that anyone would use our platform for these types of purposes. And now, of course, Facebook has done a 180 on that. But I also think that it is pretty easy to say it's their fault, not our fault. The thing that we need to do is slow down, maybe stop using social media or use it less or react slower to each other.
Stop giving Facebook and Google a pass here, right? Those guys are criminal. They're criminals as far as I'm concerned. They deliberately ran their businesses to drive profit margin at any cost. They did everything they could to override the best interests or the obvious good of the people in society just so that they could go and brag that they made another $1 billion to the community, right? So
in a discreet conversation, Greg, I might agree with you. But the reporter in me says that it is a more nuanced issue.
Of course it's nuanced. But first, I'm saying the first thing to do is to make sure that you understand that Silicon Valley is so caught up in its own self-importance, it can't actually see a rational grown-up discussion. And they still can't even accept that.
But
they still
won't
apologize.
What do you want them
apologize.
To do? I
want them to apologize. I want them to say, I'm sorry, I did something wrong, and now I'm going to make it right.
Meanwhile, Sundar Pichai says, yeah, we're making a search engine for China. What about it? What of it? I think these companies are driven as they should be. They have a fiduciary responsibility to their stakeholders by profit.
Yeah, but the stakeholders include me and the community and the society that they operate in.
Do you have Google stock?
It's not about the stock. That's the point, right?
That is the point. I think I agree with you. Morally, ethically, it's about more than the stock. But that's not how this is all configured. Is it? Can you talk an executive of a company that's got a responsibility to shareholders to raise value that they should really stop doing stuff that makes so much money?
And that's how capitalism has worked for the last 200 years.
Well, that's welcome. That's what I'm saying. And we are, by the way, in late stage capitalism. We're in the really predatory part of it.
That's exactly right. Yes.
I would write, these are incredibly nuanced and challenging issues to solve. I certainly don't have solutions, but I would like to hear from the TWIT army. You guys are very smart. You're tech savvy. And if you have solutions or if you have thoughts on particular solutions, particularly not just about election hacking, again, this has nothing to do with politics. It's everything to do with the role of technology in our life. But if you have thoughts, I'd really like to hear from you. We will take these seriously and we will, I guarantee you, we will take this into the newsroom at CBS News and examine particular solutions. And once again, this audience knows tech better than almost any audience, and your insights will be taken seriously.
How should they get a hold of you, Dan?
Just Twitter.
Join the bots. The somebody in the chat room,
disparaging.
Somebody in the chat room did say something I thought was, why don't we just shorten the election season? I mean, part of the reason this all works is we've got months to do this.
Great. How do we do that?
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, yeah, that. Seth, I feel bad for you because you got right in the middle of a very hot conversation.
But you can reply CBS News or Dan Patterson on Twitter. These are not plugs for us.
I think it's great. I think you're right. The people who listen to this show are very engaged in technology and will have opinions on, and by the way, come from across the political spectrum.
Yeah. And one thing I want to say here is this isn't just about the US. So everything that you've talked about here applies equally to Germany, to the UK, also to places you probably aren't thinking about, like Indonesia and, you know, China. I mean, what is happening with social media in China? Is it controlled by the government? And then you've got moral questions about, do we have a responsibility to interfere in other countries' operations? And at the same time, keep in mind that on one hand, Facebook is being slammed by the US government and by US citizens, but at the same time, the UK government's coming after them, as well as the European government, as well as the Australian government, and so on and so forth. So it is actually a complicated issue, but quite honestly, Facebook's going to get everything it deserves.
There's only so much we can ask of Elon Musk. Seth liked that one.
We could talk for hours about Elon.
Elon, what a character, huh? What's going on with Elon? I go back and forth. Sometimes I think, thank God Elon exists. And then sometimes I think, what the hell's going on with him?
I think he needs more time off.
Maybe that's it.
Away from social media, probably time off.
I think there's one thing. If you get one thing from this conversation, we all need time off from social media. I've never been. I don't want to beat a dead horse. I know, because I've told our audience this many times, and I'm sorry for repeating it, but I don't think these guys know. I am completely off Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and I've never felt better.
Mm. I
think probably some of you feel like, well, as a journalist, I can't get off these.
I can't get off Twitter for work, but yeah.
I'm going all in on Google Plus. I think there's a real future on the Google Plus.
Yeah.
Did you?
I know that the SEO. I know a bunch of people who are SEO fiends, and they are really quite upset because one of the best ways to jack the SEO for a website
is Google Plus.
To post content into Google Plus. Yeah.
That explains a lot about why Google Plus is the wasteland it is today.
Yeah, you'll find a lot of links in there, but apparently the code that Google wrote to poll Google Plus for links and then to prioritize it still existed. So it's one of the most popular SEO hacks is just pump rubbish into Google Plus,
so,
and you could jack your SEO.
There's a wild Twitter storm.
That was great.
It's about like 800 tweets. A guy named Morgan Knutson, who was a designer, and he's now, I think he's done a couple of startups. He's now an angel investor, so he can speak freely. He says, now that Google Plus has been shuttered, that's a little premature. It actually doesn't go out of business till August, although I feel like it's pretty much done. I should air my dirty laundry on how awful the project and the executive team was. I'm still pissed about the bait and switch. He apparently was hired at Google. They said, you're going to work on Chrome. And then they said, oh, by the way, no, you're working on Google+. Putting me on this godforsaken piece of poop on day one. He's very critical of the organization. He's, you know, he says some good things. He said Andy Hertzfeld was there. The guy's a god. It was amazing. But he said that the real problem was, well, Sundar Pichai, the guy who was in charge of Google Plus. He says Google Plus was situated in the main building, 1900, a floor away from Larry's office. Larry Page, the CEO. If you're one of the 12,000 people at Google in Mountain View who didn't work on Plus, you didn't have access to those floors. Page didn't just have an office. The entire floor was his. We all had access to it, but were encouraged to use it sparingly, a war room here and there. We had access to his cafe, too, a super fancy vegan cafe called Cloud. Have you been to Cloud? No? Who? That wouldn't be sustainable in the real world. But the reason was, he says, why this exclusivity? What made Google Plus so special? Why was it held so close to Google's chest? I'd find out later. The senior vice president of Plus used his clout to swing all of this. His name was Vic Gundotra. He was relatively charismatic. I remember him frequently flirting with the women on the team. Gave me a compounded, horrible impression of him. He says, I worked there 8 months. Vic never said one word to me. No hello, no goodbye, no thanks for staying late, no handshake, not even any eye contact. Vic's product vision was fear-based. Google built the knowledge graph, and Facebook has swooped in and built the social graph. And if Google doesn't own the social graph, then we can't claim to have indexed all the world's data. It made sense at the time. So much so that, as we know, Google was giving people bonuses based on the success of Google+. If your team, say Android or Gmail, was to integrate Google+ features, then you would get a 1.5 to 3 times multiplier on top of your yearly bonus.
We actually knew that at the time.
I remember.
Reported,
yeah.
And yeah. Not as controversial as it is in this particular context. But
he said, you know, he writes, a F ton of money to ruin the product you were building with bloated garbage no one wanted. Nobody really liked this, but people drank the Kool-Aid because it was mostly green and made of paper.
I've done that. everything in this rant is like, sure, done that. Worked in a... I've worked in big companies all over the world, and you know, the CEO gets a hard on for a particular project, or a senior executive decides that this is going to be his road to the top. And you know what? The road to the top might not actually be inside the company he's working for. It might be a project that he can put on his resume and carry over to the next company and say, look, I did this. You should hire me for 5 times what I'm currently earning. Nothing in this rant strikes me as anything but like, sure, whatever. Sounds normal.
Business as usual in a big American company. He does. Knutson writes, I had the comment, and I want to make sure we say this. Common thread between 99.8% of the people that I interacted with at Google is they were ethical, highly intelligent, and hardworking. I had a lot of admiration and respect for many of them. But this team that he was on, this Google Plus team, was horrifically dysfunctional. Furthermore, there was the kind of dysfunction that we saw at Microsoft that I think has been fixed since, where different fiefdoms would basically say our success is paramount, your success just gets in our way. He talks about designing a way to get chat into Google Plus, and he said the whole vision was, my vision was to integrate Google's other apps into this sidebar navigation. He did it. He approached the guy over at Gmail, and the Gmail guy said, are you kidding? We're trying to put this in Gmail. If we let you do this from Google Plus, it's going to make us look bad. Google I.O. is coming up. The hell with that. We're not doing it. And that's, you see that all the time in these kinds of big corporations where different, you know, product lines basically, I mean, for years, Office and Windows sabotaged each other at Microsoft. But you make a good point, Greg. This is
normal. It especially happens in companies that are making vast wads of cash, where egos are large, right? I've worked in various dot-com companies since 1998, and I've seen people come in and, you know, throw around the ego and the big words and spend up big on these projects. And I've worked with plenty of dysfunctional projects where this is not new to me. The challenge here is that when companies are just awash with cash like this, this sort of stuff happens and nobody notices or cares. And this is happening, I think, right the way through Silicon Valley. These companies have so much money Even like startups who run around complaining how little money they have. I tell you what, you want to run a small business in the backwoods of Australia or the US, and I promise you, you'll discover what a lack of cash.
Uber is planning an IBO, for example. Uber is planning an IBO next year for a IPO for $120 billion.
Yeah, so they think. But, you know, like, that's just
not
so
the story, but we'll get
much
to that story.
Money, but that's just so much amazing money that this sort of dysfunction becomes institutionalized because you can throw away these projects. And remember how Google used to just let people work on stuff and they'd go off and work, and then suddenly a group of people would come up with an idea and they'd spend 2 years working on something that had no purpose and no point? That's what this is. No big deal.
Actually, what do you think of that? What do you think of that, Seth Weintraub? You cover, of course, electric vehicles and electric. Is Uber's $120 billion? It's not their valuation. It's their IPO.
That was reported by the Wall Street Journal, I believe. And it was kind of quoting some bankers. So, you know, a little bit of grains of salt with that. And another thing that kind of interests me about Uber a little bit more is that their CEO, Dana, can't remember his last name, mentioned that half of their...
You can remember it. You just don't know how to pronounce it. I know. Dara Khosrowshahi.
Khorodowski.
What?
Yes.
Oh, you're not talking about Uber now? Somebody else? I'm sorry.
Anyway.
Pardon me. Excuse me. Edit me out there. Thank you.
Half of the business would be scooters and bikes.
Yeah, so Uber owns Lime,
and they also have like this Jump electric bike company. So they're kind of expanding their like breadth a little bit. Yeah. $120 billion seems a little bit crazy to me because there's quite a bit of competition, and that you know that moats and castles thing isn't really too deep. You know, Lime in particular on that side is very strong. You know. Lyft and there's a ton of other like smaller car sharing companies. So I don't see a $100 billion valuation for Uber. It seems a little bit crazy. They were talking in the 50 to 70 previously, so I think that's probably a little bit more realistic. But you know, I'm not a banker.
Strikes me that the valuation, certainly the amount of money they've raised. And then if they have some inflated valuation at an IPO, is not for their current business, the ride sharing business, but it is all about the future of Uber with the self-driving car business, right?
Absolutely. So think of Uber as Netflix of, you know, way right. back when
they were still sending CDs out, their DVDs
Uber,
out. Yeah.
Uber has no plans in the future to have humans or meat. Right. You know, in their vehicles. They're all about self-driving.
The
everything.
Meat is costing them the profit. Get
right.
rid of the meat, you can make money.
Exactly. So that's right now they're sending DVDs to people. That's what they're doing. That's their current situation. But they don't, they're Uber. They're going to be a self-driving, you know, human delivery service or, you know, delivery of
well, that's,
any kind of service.
Speaking of
didn't
which.
Didn't they sell off that part of the business or shut it down recently?
Well, I think, yes, because they got in a lot of trouble
ambitions.
When they ran over somebody and killed her.
Yeah. I think that's on the back burner, but I don't think.
But I don't think there's a business if you don't get rid of the meat.
I mean, there's going to be a lot of competition.
Right.
I mean, clearly that's where Silicon Valley is putting a lot of their engineers right
look
now.
Look at Instacart, which just raised another $600 million. Instacart is a $7.6 billion company. They deliver groceries.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's a lot of competition in that space. In fact, from some of the biggest companies in the world, like Amazon.
Kind of feels a little bubbly right now.
A little bubbly.
Yeah.
We don't really cover the market, but I just, since you brought up these crazy amounts of money that they're throwing around in Silicon Valley, I thought I'd just mention.
Palantir, yeah. $40 billion next year.
$40 billion. Right? What is it? Palantir's a security company, right?
Yeah, Palantir is one of the most interesting companies in the world right now. They are
they're a Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah.
Are they?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not because they don't engage in the same extra legal activities that
But this is Peter Thiel's company. And
They are a data analysis firm, and they work with law enforcement. So, I mean, we can just say data, right? And they have some of the smartest people in data. They're also a very tough egg to crack, but just on the IPO train.
Extremely secretive.
Yeah, for a company that we have almost no visibility into, a $40 billion IPO seems staggering.
Yeah. Well, remember, there's a lot of money floating around, and investors are just desperately trying to find the next big thing. And all you really see with these valuations and these IPOs is what a certain group of people think is going to be the next big thing. And they may well be wrong.
Looking for the next Facebook and getting the next Google Plus.
That's the story right in a nutshell. Right there.
There's a lot of fashion following going on in Silicon Valley at the moment. Everybody, once a particular thing looks like it's got legs, all the investors rush to get in there. Especially the funds.
For crying out loud, look at Hollywood. I mean, they don't make a new movie. They just remake Mary Poppins. Look at Broadway. They don't write a new play. They just take an old one and put music to it. I mean, it's not like innovation is the dominant theme.
But the trends that they follow is they're all rushing back to the musical since the success of Mona. And then before that, it was rushing back to the comic books, DC and Marvel. And there was a whole rash of those.
It's artists will do what artists do. The problem is that businesses like Broadway and Hollywood and all these are not run by visionaries and creatives. They're run by bean counters. And bean counters say, well, that worked. Let's do that again.
Yeah. We can allocate funds to that because I feel that the return on investment would be there. This is exactly – and the trick here is that back when Hollywood was making way too much money, back in the 50s and 60s, and they basically couldn't stuff enough cash in their shirt. They were able to do stupid things. Look at all the different crazy movies that they made in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that made no sense. And that's what Silicon Valley is doing, the same sort of thing.
San Francisco had a problem with scooters. There were a lot of them, and they were littering the streets. Seth, are you in Santa Monica? Are you down?
I'm actually based in New York.
Oh, you're in Brooklyn or somewhere like that.
Yeah, north, but yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a scooter issue there? Because if you go down to Santa Monica, you can hardly walk.
Yeah, they're everywhere. I've been there quite a few times since they rolled out. Actually, they just came to Paris. I was at the auto show in Paris, and it totally changed the city, like made it so much better.
Yeah, on the one hand, I love it because you can just get one and scoot somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great city for it, except for the cobblestone.
A little dangerous in a city that is built around autos.
Right.
But the problem, so San Francisco had this problem that all these companies, including Uber's Lime, came in and just dumped scooters. Big trucks pulled up and they threw the scooters on the streets, and it was a mess. So they banned them all, and they said, we're going to pick two. On Monday, they picked Skip and Scoot, which somebody, I think Heather Hammond in the radio show, said sounds like a... Brent Kavanaugh's drinking buddies, but Skip and Scoot, and then Lime got so pissed off they went to the court and tried to get an injunction. But the court said no. The city has a right to do this.
Yep.
Is electric going to cover scooters?
Oh, we cover scooters quite a bit. It's not something that we initially were thinking about when we. Built the site.
No one was. Nobody expects the scooter inquisition.
Right. But now it's like one of our big topic areas.
Is it really?
So, yeah.
And in general, are you positive on all this?
I personally am. I think the bigger problem is the cities building the infrastructure around it. I think, if cities want to have, fewer cars.
You need bike lanes. You need scooter lanes. You need places to safely scoot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you also need to create societal rules around putting scooters back. They arrived while I was in Lisbon for a few weeks last month, and the scooters literally, when I was first arrived, there was no scooters, and then all of a sudden there was this litter in the shape of a scooter all over
everywhere.
The streets, and they were literally just being abandoned in the most interesting places. Lisbon does have a bit of a problem with youth and graffiti and stuff, and so there's quite a few of them sitting in that water. Where people had just tossed them over the edge.
Same thing happened in San Francisco. And I think it's happened in L.A. They just throw them in the ocean.
In Britain, I think – I'm trying to remember the article, but I think it was Electric Bikes in Manchester. A company moved in there without any council permissions and just started putting bikes on the streets.
Yeah.
And the loss rate on those bicycles was so high they had to leave within 3 months.
Google said that.
Literally, people were just gas axing off the bits and the batteries and turning them into their own personal bikes.
If you go down to Mountain View and look at the creeks, you'll see all these Google bikes kind of tossed in the creeks. It's a new kind of urban pollution. I like this. This is an article from Electric on electric mopeds. I see. I like this idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's quite a few nice ones coming. You know, a lot of them are based in China, but you know, Vespa's coming out with an electric scooter, which you know, carries all that cachet. Piaggio or whatever. There's quite a few like name brand scooter companies coming out with electric versions.
I would love an electric Vespa. That would be the height of cool, wouldn't it? This is a Flux. It kind of looks like a Vespa.
Yeah, those are a little bit lower powered, but also a lot less expensive. I believe this is like $2,500.
I just bought a Super 73 electric bike because it looks...
Oh, man, those are great, right?
Yeah. I think it was a Kickstarter, and they look like Indian motorcycles, kind of. They look like old school motorcycles, but they're electric bikes.
I wouldn't compare that to an Indian motorcycle, but I think they're awesome.
Okay. They got fat tires.
They're still awesome. Yes.
I can't
came from
wait.
I have with the. I'd love the idea of an electric scooter. And I actually, because I don't own a car, I actually looked into buying these, but they're stupidly expensive and also stupidly insecure.
Right.
So I don't feel I can drive this into town and just leave it parked up on the side of the road because people can just pick it up and put it in the back of a car and drive away with it.
Yeah, there has to be some more safety. Some companies are actually putting GPS in them, like a car.
Right.
So you can actually trace where they're at. There's a company called VanMoof out of the Netherlands that has a nice one that you can trace with your smartphone app. But you know, cities need to put infrastructure in. I don't know if sharing is going to eventually end up being the way to go. I mean, you know, these scooters are getting so light and foldable that you can almost you know, 5 or 10 pounds, you know, carry it with you, plug it in at your desk. And that means
our son uses a scooter to get to school. He's a junior or sophomore in high school. And we're very lucky. I don't know why, because it makes no sense at all. But at some point, the area spent $1 billion on a light rail service that goes basically from nowhere to nowhere anyone wants to go. However, it stops in Petaluma. It goes from Santa Rosa to San Rafael. And it was like a huge expense, but it's fabulous. It's a nice light rail. You get on this smart train. So he scooters to the smart train, gets in the smart train. You can put your bike or scooter there, gets off, scooters another, I think it's about a mile to school. It's the greatest thing ever. But he has his own scooter. He's not renting them. So at one point, Lime scooters, actually this became a big issue, screamed, "Unlock me or I'll call the police," when they're touched. And this was a big problem in San Francisco. A female voice from within Lime's e-scooters shout the threat to anyone who tries to fiddle with them without downloading the app and paying. The companies also set their rides to blast cartoonish robot noises so loud that heads turn on busy streets. They disabled that because people figured out that actually they can't possibly call the police. They're just saying it. It's just an empty threat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I mean, theoretically, they could call the police, but it's a bad, bad PR message.
Yeah, don't call the police.
How dumb are these people to think that they're going to get away with that, right? Like, how much stupid can you put in one place?
That's not stupid. That's innovation.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't want to.
Rolls eyes. I mean, Jesus.
All right.
These people are idiots. I mean, is there any signs that these people are anything but idiots? I mean, all the evidence points to them being complete, absolute idiots. They can't get it right. They don't even make the scooters. They buy them in bulk from China and then litter them around the streets and call it an innovation. Honestly?
but they have the $2 billion valuations now. So
that sounds pretty smart to me.
That's innovative.
I'll do it.
That doesn't mean they'll have $2 billion valuation tomorrow. I remember the 1999.com bust.
Yeah, but now who's stupid? Because they're going to take a little bit of that off the table. And here we are slogging away in the vital and growing podcast movement.
That's I'm doing okay.
You're good. I'm glad to hear.
I'm not exactly getting Facebook rich or Google rich, but I'm doing okay.
All right, doing okay. We're doing okay.
Yeah.
Our show today, Brett. I'm just teasing you, Craig.
Speaking of which.
Packet Pushers Network, ladies and gentlemen, packetpushers.net. Actually, great place for enterprise podcasts. Fabulous. Is that the right address, packetpushers.net?
Packetpushers.net is us, yeah. We're publishing 8 channels of podcast content now across a wide spectrum of enterprise IT. There's me on my snarky channels, but there's other people who say really intelligent things on those channels. So if you're interested in enterprise IT, you should tune into those.
Yeah.
I want to call out one channel, if I can, Leo, yes, which is our IPv6 Buzz channel. For those people who are doing networking, IPv6 is the new nirvana. It's the innovation. And all they talk about is IPv6, of all things.
Good
Lord.
It's
quite amazing.
When you say channel, yeah, like, are they on 24/7 talking about it?
They publish twice every 2 weeks a show on just IPv6 technology and how to deploy it.
My God. Packetpushers.net. Yeah. Also, Dan Patterson from Tech Republic. He's a senior writer there. And do tune in to cbsnews.com/electionhacking. Is that the right URL, Dan?
It is. I'm actually at CBS News and CNET these days, but I dearly love our friends at Tech Republic.
Oh, you've moved to, oh, I'm so confused. It's all owned by the same company.
It's all owned. Look, my every day is CBS News. Everything I write is for CBS News. Oh, my chyron says CNET, and I also love my colleagues at CNET.
You're CBS
every
News
day
now.
Is CBS.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. CBSnews.com/live. And from Electrek and 9 to 5 Mac, the publisher and legend in the business, Seth Weintraub. Great to have you, Seth.
Thanks, Leo.
Anything you want to plug?
The sites.
The sites.
If you like electric cars and Lime scooters, Electrek's where you
want
to go.
I read electric. Should I buy a Model 3 or not?
Yes, you should.
Everybody loves it. Yeah.
It's a nice, there's all these, there's every issue in the world but the car is great.
Yeah. And I'm already a Model X owner. I know. Or is it a Model 10? I can never tell. I know what it means to own a Tesla.
Yeah, they're great cars. Like, every time I get into an internal combustion engine car these days, I'm always like, man, this is just silly.
I won't drive a nice car anymore. It's out.
Yeah.
Right out for me. I'm trying to get my wife out of them. Anyway, great to have all three of you. Our show today, yes, this is where I monetize. Actually, we have great sponsors, and I love each and every one of them. This and one of the things we try to do with our sponsors is pick companies we use and work with. And in this case, ZipRecruiter, man, I had an amazing experience. So ZipRecruiter is it's not a job site exactly. It's a one place you go to post your job listing and get it on 100 job sites, on Twitter, on Facebook. But it does even more, because what ZipRecruiter does is it actually brings you candidates. That's smart. It's not go to a job site and wait for a candidate to apply to your job. That's not smart. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit, and the right person will get in touch, because ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the candidates finding you. It finds them for you. It uses powerful matching technology. Once you put your listing up there, it scans thousands of resumes, identifies people who have the skills, the education, the experience for your job, and then says to them, hey, I got a great job for you. Actively invites them to apply so you get qualified candidates fast. And we know this. About 2 months ago, our accounting manager, our bookkeeper, quit, gave us 2 weeks' notice. Now, Lisa, my wife, who runs the company, has a lot of experience. She's been controller of big companies, so she can do it. But she's going, I have a million things to do that are more important. I don't want to have to keep, but I got to hire somebody. And this is the problem, is you're down a person, and you've got to do the hiring, and it's just twice as much work. And she was really kind of in the dumps. This is at breakfast. I'm saying, well, Lisa, ZipRecruiter. She posted on ZipRecruiter. Before lunch, she starts getting candidates, and she's looking at each one and go, wow, this person's great. This person's even better. Fabulous. Before lunch, we had 3 or 4 applicants. That's how fast it was. On average, you're going to have at least one highly qualified applicant within the first 24 hours. I'd say it's even faster than that. That's why ZipRecruiter is number one with employers in the U.S. This is from Trustpilot, over 1,000 reviews, number one. It is a fantastic system. All the applicants go into the ZipRecruiter interface. It's making it very easy to rank them, screen them, and hire the right person fast. You can have screening questions. They reformat all the resumes so it's easy to scan through them. It is a really great applique, and you see all the companies that use ZipRecruiter, some of the biggest companies in the world, including Twit. It made Lisa very happy, and we got that person hired fast. You could do the same. Try it free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Yeah, free. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter.com/twit for your free trial. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Let's see here. So many things to talk about. Invitations went out to an Apple event in your neck of the woods, Seth. It's going to be in New York this time.
It's very exciting. I don't think they've had a real New York hardware event since like Macworld Expo's time type of.
When they did the updated iPads for Education, they had that at a school in New York. But this one's going to be in Brooklyn.
Oh, that's right.
It's going to be the Brooklyn School of Music. And they sent out invitations to everybody but me.
And
I didn't get one.
We're now on the poopy list again.
Are you on the poopy list? 9 to 5 Mac? Are you kidding?
You know how we did we released the Apple Watch 4 and the iPhones.
You told people about you.
Yeah,
the leaks.
We had all of it.
Yeah.
Our invitations didn't come for that event, and then. Our invitations
and never again.
Of anything.
Yeah.
So we're kind of on the bad boy list again.
I'm on that list.
I could come.
I don't really care. Although this time they did something really interesting. They made different Apple logos, like dozens of them, for these invitations. I mean, I don't know how many, but there are so many of them. And the event invitations all say the same thing, which is, you know, I don't know, come help us spend customers money. Well, I like that one. That's iron filings, it looks like. That's cool. Look at all of them. This is from The Verge. They collected as many as they could. It is clearly going to be, it's October 30th, which is funny because OnePlus was going to have their event on October 30th announcing the new OnePlus 6T, and whoops, so they moved it a day earlier. You don't really want to be at the same time. It's going to be early in the morning. I'm going to come in here and do it for us on the West Coast, 7 a.m. Pacific, that's 10 a.m. Eastern, October 30th. It's almost certain it'll be at least new iPads and iPad Pros, probably bezel-less with no home button. You guys probably have all, you probably have seen them, you've held them, you know all about them, right?
We haven't touched them, but we've heard quite a bit about them. And, you know, they're going to have the Face ID as well. And what's kind of cool, and I think you'll appreciate this, Leo, is I think they're going to have USB-C.
That's a real shock. I've seen that rumor. They're going to abandon the Lightning port?
That's, I don't know if they're going to abandon it on this particular device. I think they're going to have both.
Both?
Which is super interesting for Apple, right? Yeah. So
I think they have to. I think you're right, Seth, because logically everybody's got Lightning connectors and Lightning accessories, you know, Lightning to SD cards and Lightning headphones and all sorts of things. If they suddenly switched over to USB, and keep in mind that a lot of those USB connectors that you need to plug into all the accessories that you've got is actually a big deal. I do think that might be possible.
It would be like huge. Most phones now are Type-C, except for Apple.
And there is a European directive to drive them to force them to use USB-C.
What's so interesting is not just the money and time that Apple spent converting their audience from their consumers from the 30 pin to the new connectors, but by all accounts, they were pushing for wireless to be the replacement. We're not going to USB-C. Instead, we're going to
no
wireless.
Connect. No connect.
And I mean, this
that would be courage.
That would be courage. But to abandon that, and it appears as though the charging pads are nowhere to be seen.
Yeah,
and
that
to
was
abandon
a flop.
That for USB-C. Some sort of corporate machination happened behind the scene where they abandoned one direction and are now pushing in this interesting USB-C direction.
Wow. So I'd heard the rumor they would do USB-C, but I did not know that people were thinking both Lightning and USB-C on one device. That's interesting.
And we're hearing for USB-C that they're going to have a mirrored display out via USB-C. So you can put up a 4K, 4K display, and then theoretically you have a Bluetooth keyboard or, you know, whatever kind of keyboard and mouse. And, you know, if there's a mouse, then all of a sudden you have a cursor on the iPad and all these like computery things start happening. And then all of a sudden Apple's not making Macs anymore. They're making iPads.
Well, and I think that we've been thinking that that was the tenor of the
So this is the company. Next step in that.
Yeah. That is very interesting. Yeah, I mean, after all, we all saw the ad where the girl's running around with her iPad, and finally her dad says, okay, time to put away the PC, and she says, what's a PC?
And what's a computer?
Maybe what's a computer? Maybe want a slugger. Because I like Macs. I don't want to lose Macintosh. The big stopping point, the one thing that Apple has to solve is you need a Mac to develop apps for the iOS.
Yeah, and it's also kind of interesting that, you know, now you can get Microsoft Office for iPad. You can get now Adobe Photoshop coming for iPad.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
But you can't get Final Cut Pro, Apple's own, and you can't get Xcode, and you can't get, you know, any of their Pro apps for iPad, which is like, you know, like, what is going on there?
Do you think they'll maybe have some announcements on the 30th?
It would be nice. I think a lot of people are looking forward.
What about the Mac? Does that mean they're, because one thing that Mac aficionados like me are holding out for is an updated MacBook or MacBook Air or a Mac Mini. Any chance we'll see those announcements?
I think there's going to be a big Mac portion of this event. I don't know if there's going to be a Mini. Like, it's been like 5 years or something.
That's
crazy.
Ridiculous.
You know, it kind of feels like the headless Mac is, you know, long gone, but it would be nice to get a Mac Mini, and Apple has promised a Mac Pro next year.
Right.
But
those new Intel chips, those new workstation, 265-watt right. workstation chips, the new Xeons would be perfect for a Mac Pro.
And especially if you want to heat up your
265
office.
Watts. Jeez Louise.
I'm hanging on to my mid 2012 MacBook Pro 15 inch because I think that I'm just fingers crossed that there's something coming on October 30 because I'll be all up in the grill of that. 6 years is as long as I can make that laptop last.
God, if they put the touch bar on it though.
But the Mac Mini is very important for the education market. Apple's losing a lot of share to the Chromebooks in particular.
Is that because of price or because it's compact, it's headless, as Seth said? Why Mac Mini?
The advantage of the Chromebook in the education, I spoke to a number of IT CIOs of schools a couple of years ago about it, and they said, first of all, Chromebooks are cheap. They can buy them for £200 to £300
Apple has nothing in that price range.
But in terms of maintaining them, they blow the pants off iPads because a Chromebook, you just site it up, and then the person logs in, and then everything comes from Google. So if you've got a kid, they file in, they pick a Chromebook up off the thing, and then they sit down at the desk and away they go. If that Chromebook flames out, they just put it on the pile to be repaired and pick up another one and log in and away they go.
Yeah.
So Apple is very much losing ground with its software here compared to Google. Google's winning the hearts and minds of schools very, very much so because, you know, you can get a classroom of laptops for under $10,000 basically.
Right. Here's an interesting piece by Dave Smith in Business Insider. It's time for tech giants to retire the keynote. Apple, Google, and others are all making the same mistake with their product launches. Dave says they're too long. They're not very efficient. It would make so much more sense to do these online. And because tech companies can't keep a secret, and we saw this with Google's event, there was nothing for Google to say that we didn't already know. I suspect that may be true for Apple's event on the 30th. He says keynotes should evolve into online debuts. You agree, Dan Patterson?
Yeah, I think that particularly given the challenges experienced by nearly every major technology firm in the last 18 months or so, look, there was excitement in a more naive era, but we've obviously transitioned into a different time. And these big, boastful, hubristic events communicate a hubris that is hard for many people to relate to. And we need a dose of humility right now from technology firms that have invaded our lives with products and data that has arguably made life less fun and showing off, hey, look at our big fancy products, especially when we're long overdue for a recession, is maybe a misstep. I might be wrong about that. And I certainly love getting excited about technology products. And I kind of long for the days where these were few and far between. But I think these companies run the risk of appearing too big and alienating their consumers, or seeming out of touch from their consumers.
What do you think, Seth?
So the purpose of a keynote has kind of evolved a little bit. And, you know, the Steve Jobs Apple keynote was kind of like the, you know, I guess the one to model yourself after. And you would actually learn quite a bit about the product. Like, if you remember the iPhone keynote, you know, he explained like how the scrolling worked. Because this was, you know, this was a new UX language. Like, nobody had seen anything like this before. And, you know, show after show, you would kind of learn how the new stuff worked. And it was kind of like a big, like, this is it. You know, this is what you're going to be learning for the next 6 months.
It was also very valuable because Apple could position stuff.
Right.
So not only would they say this is what it does and how it does it, but they could, you know, it's a iPhone. It's a phone. It's an internet communicator. It's an iPod. It's a communicator phone. He really set the language for what these
Absolutely.
New devices were.
And you know, I don't know if in particular with Apple, I don't know if it's that their products aren't as, you know, motivational
Novel?
Or like, you know, I don't know if
novel's a good word. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the new iPhones, they're just like the iPhone 10,
except kind of like
faster,
the old iPhone.
Yeah, and the camera's a little better. And,
yeah.
You know, the watch screen is a little bit bigger. And, you know, the keynote's over. Go home.
You know, I do agree with you, Dan, that I don't see – in the tech community, we're all excited about these. And, boy, do these companies get a lot of coverage. We actually stream them and comment on them, and it's a great way to get press. That's why OnePlus is moving
cool.
its event, right? There's a lot of attention on these, especially on Apple events, even if there's nothing novel to announce. But I do think you made an interesting point, Dan, that maybe the general public is going to start looking askance at these.
I think the general public has already started doing that, yeah. And it can appear tone deaf to have a bunch of incredibly affluent people stand up on stage and present devices that are well out of your budget and say, look at this fantastic thing. We might change your life, but it's probably going to be the same as the thing already in your pocket, but cost you more money. This is not me poo-pooing these events, but I think that we are simply in a different era. We don't need to have this new language explained to us anymore. We all understand this intuitively,
right?
How to use our devices and what they do and the benefits that they can bring to our lives.
Hence, we understand 10 minutes, devoting 10 minutes to Memojis, right?
Yeah.
But those are, I think there's a difference here between what Apple does, and I think Apple gets it for more or less right. They save. Four keynotes, they bring very visual things and they tell stories and they do it reasonably well. But they also don't hold a keynote for everything. It's not like sometimes they'll introduce minor refreshes of an iPad, but they don't hold a keynote for it and make a big press event out of that. They generally have something to say. The challenge here is when Google stands up and announces the Pixel 3, which nobody buys and nobody uses and nobody should reasonably care about, but somehow the press has glommed around it like flies around a can of poop and treated it like it's the next Nirvana and it's the alternative to the iPhone. But the Pixel 3 is literally going to sell as many phones in a year as many iPhone. It'll sell in a year the number of phones that Apple sells in 5 days. Nobody should be commenting about the Pixel 3. The challenge here is that the media industry is chasing after the wrong thing. They see Apple doing a media event, they give it the coverage. So when somebody else does a media event, they give it the same level of coverage without qualifying it, right? They should be backing off from it and saying, Google's going to announce a phone that nobody buys. I should not be covering that. It's not a big story.
I have a data point along that line because I used to do every Friday morning, I would talk to the big morning show in Los Angeles on KFI about stuff. And I was just told, let's stop talking about product releases. We want to talk about philosophy. We want to talk about bigger stories. And in fact, I remember I never wanted to cover cell phones and gadgets, but I felt forced into it by the huge interest and demand for that. Well, I think it's now shifting and it's gone away again. I think that's very
interesting. I think we're seeing the end of the product releases because it's become tedious, but it's also cheap journalism. Get a product, hold it up. What's the color of it? How good's the camera? You know,
I resent that.
It is. It's cheap.
I'll do
it's
it only if people want it.
Yeah.
But I think
I resemble that.
We've never. Yeah, me too. In Seth. Packet pushes,
that's,
we've
that's
never
our
covered.
Bread and butter. This guy's hitting here.
Yeah. In packet pushes, we've never covered the latest.
When you look at a phone anymore, like this is a Pixel. You know, so some people do buy these things. It's just a screen. Like that's all it is anymore. Now it's got a notch, but like.
Yesterday on the screensavers, I put the Pixel 3 next to the iPhone XS and next to the Note 9. And unless you knew what you were looking at, they were completely indistinguishable. They're all roughly the same 6-inch slabs of glass.
Right.
Yeah, but in our network, we've never covered new product releases unless there's a generational change. So just because, you know, Cisco, Juniper, you know, Extreme releases a 32-port switch with 100 gig interfaces.
Yeah, but that's because you're covering an incredibly boring, mature industry.
Yeah. But the product releases are boring, right?
Well, maybe not. I mean, for a while, they were pretty exciting. In fact, we've got a new iPhone coming out on Friday, the XR. Are your people, Seth, all excited about the XR?
Yeah, we're getting quite a bit of buzz about that.
I feel like that's going to be the phone that sells, although, and I don't know if this is useful or not, but if you go to order a XR, you can easily still get it on Friday.
Unless you're on T-Mobile. T-Mobile, I think, had a little bit of shortage, but everybody else is pretty solid.
I went in to get the T-Mobile version the day after, and I couldn't get it fast enough, but the chat room said, just get the AT&T or the Verizon one. They're all unlocked, and you just get whatever one you want.
Yeah.
So I haven't checked today, but there was no line. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, they're able to build quite a few of these, so even if...
Maybe that's
10 million sold.
Yeah. They've had plenty of time to ramp this up since the announcement a month ago. Right.
The only one that's not available in the UK is the 64 gig. I can order the 128 and the 256, and it'll deliver on Friday.
Can you get the banana phone? The yellow one?
Let's have a look. I'll check for you. Check stock while we're live.
Check stock on the banana phone, because I think that's the one apparently that's the one everybody wants, is the yellow one.
So 2-week delay on the 64 gig and 128, but you can have the 256 gig.
I want to ask you guys, because, you know, we talk about this a little bit. Do you notice that there's like a big bezel around the edge of the XR or the XR?
That's what people are complaining about, that compared to the XS, the XR...
Yeah, it's an LCD display, so they can't go quite to the edge. But it almost feels like there's like a big bezel all the way around.
Oh, isn't that funny?
And they're kind of cheating it a little bit.
Oh, isn't that funny? There's still a notch, but there's still a notch. There's a bigger bezel,
quite a bit bigger if you look at it.
Oh, that's interesting. Now here's the question:
and people care about that?
Well, they might, because this isn't that much cheaper. It's $750 for the 64 gig. So
it's a really expensive phone.
It's pretty expensive.
A couple years ago, that was flagship.
Yeah. So, if you're getting it for $500, you might say, well, who cares?
Sure.
That's interesting. And they.
I look at iPhone and phone reviews these days and go, like, what are you people on about? It's just a bloody phone.
What do you carry?
I really don't get it anymore.
What's your phone?
You know.
What's your phone, Greg?
I don't know.
You don't care. He doesn't know and he doesn't care.
I think it's a iPhone 8. Thing.
It doesn't really matter, does it?
No, couldn't give a toss.
And by the way, if you take Facebook and Twitter and Instagram off your phone, there's really no reason to look at it at all.
Oh, well, I don't take telephone calls on it either.
No.
The truth is, I
no longer need my phone. Nobody calls me. Text messages. No. If I had a little... Somebody should make a little thing that you could hook on your belt, maybe this, I don't know, the size of a Altoids tin, that just had a screen on it, would tell you your text messages. That's all
I need. Like the size of a watch?
Yeah, somebody could invent something like that.
I use my watch more than I use my iPhone these days. Because I've actually disabled the voice.
Your watch, unlike mine, tells the time. Mine doesn't tell the time unless you shake it. You give it a good shake.
Yeah.
Maybe not even then.
Yeah.
I'm so depressed. You guys are making me so depressed. There's used to be, I can at least say, well, the world's going to hell, but at least we've got cool gadgets.
Yeah.
We do have cool gadgets.
Do we?
You could.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you.
You can take photos of it as it goes to hell. Yeah. Isn't that going to be great?
Scooters and Teslas. That's where it's at.
Scooters and Teslas. They're the future. All right. Let's take a break, and then we'll talk about Google's plan to screw the EU. I got something you'll be interested in. My friend David Friend, who was the CEO of Carbonite, and his partner at Carbonite, Jeff Flowers, are very clever guys. And while they're still on, I'm sure they're still on the board at Carbonite, they realized they had a little bit of free time, and they had also some really amazing technology that had allowed them to, in the days of Carbonite, store stuff really fast, really efficiently on hard drives. It was really the core technology, the patented technology that made Carbonite happen. And they said, you know, we shouldn't let this technology just be for Carbonite. What if we made this hot cloud storage? And Wasabi was born. Wasabi, hot cloud storage. And by the way, this is in business, as you know, is a huge issue right now. According to I guess IDC, one of the analysts, there will be an estimated, I can't believe this, 163 zettabytes of data storage by 2025. That's 21 zeros. That's a crazy amount of data. And we're storing it in the cloud, and we're storing it essentially at three big companies. But there's a better way, Wasabi. And if you're looking at hot cloud storage right now, I want you to add a fourth company to the list that you're looking at. Wasabi results in storage thanks to this technology that's 80% cheaper and six times faster than S3. Plus, they don't charge for egress, free unlimited egress. They just have one basic tier of service. It's completely secure. In fact, really, I think you can make the case that it's more secure than your on-prem storage. It's HIPAA compliant, FINRA compliant, CJIS compliant. 80% less than S3, six times faster, with 11 nines of data durability. And to add to that, they've created a category of immutable storage. Storage, you say, I don't want this ever to change. It is protected against accidental or malicious deletions or modifications. It's immutable. They have something called the Wasabi Ball that allows you to quickly migrate petabytes of data directly to the Wasabi Cloud. It is hot. WASABI, Wasabi, just like Wasabi, but it's cloud storage. It's not hot radish. If you go to wasabi.com, you click the free trial link and use the code TWIT, you'll get a month of unlimited storage for free so you can test it. And when you see the price and when you go to your boss and say, look, we're going to save 80% and it's six times faster and it's 11 nines durable and it's got free egress, no charge for API calls, immutable storage, I think you're going to see it is a great choice. Oh, by the way, it's fully S3 API compliant. So if you've already got S3 stuff that you're using, don't worry. It'll all work. Wasabi. I love these guys. David and Jeff are brilliant. And I think they've done it again. And that's why I'm really happy to tell you about Wasabi. Try it right now. Put it on your list. Wasabi.com. Don't forget the offer code TWIT so they know about where you heard it.
This is a segment of the market that's absolutely white hot. There's over 70 storage startups in enterprise IT. Yeah. Just startups in addition to the 15 to 20 odd billion dollar plus established players in this market. It's just vital. There's so many different ways to store your data these days. It's amazing.
And I think you would agree that in most cases, these are more secure than your on-prem storage. And, you know, most of the time people got a couple of drives in the closet.
It's complicated. It can certainly be much better. The actual arrays are much more, the data storage is much more reliable and stable. The challenge here is that a lot of people put data in the cloud but then forget to back it up.
Right.
Because if you put it in the cloud, it's safe, but the challenge is...
you got to have more than one
if
copy.
Somebody corrupts the data. If somebody corrupts the copy, how do you get back to with the uncorrupted copy?
And so I always talk about this when we talk about backup, because what people do is they label a drive backup, they copy the data to it, they say, it's backed up, and then delete the original. It's like, no, it's not backed up. It's not backed up! Yeah. Just because it's on a drive called backup does not make it backed up.
No.
So Google is getting, I think this is one of those screw you moments. Remember that the EU fined Google, what was it, $5 billion antitrust fine. And one of the things they said is, you know, one of the things Google did wrong was they were telling companies that wanted the Google apps on their Android devices, okay, but you can't make non, you know, you can't make AOSP devices. You have to make all Google devices. You have to include Chrome and Google Search. And the EU said, no, you can't do that anymore. So Google said, okay, but that was how we made money. So now if OEMs in Europe want to put Android, what put Google services on Android, we're going to charge them as much as $40 a phone.
Yeah.
Screw you, Europe.
That's what Microsoft did with Internet Explorer when they unbundled
it. Yeah, we'll
charge
you.
That's not new. Yeah. I mean, $5 billion is not a bad taxation gain. It's still cheaper than paying the tax they should have paid for the last 15 years.
It is a significant increase, and if you're in the EU, you might notice these phones are going to cost a little bit more.
I don't think anybody cares because over here people buy the phones outright. They don't rent them from their carriers. It's very getting increasingly uncommon to actually buy them as part of a package, like a pay per month
right.
for
it's
them.
It's the same here in the States. Although they hide that in various ways, you know.
Yeah, there's lots of ways. I think this
if I'm is Apple, perfectly... I'm thrilled. I'm going, great. Yeah. Finally, we can get some market share in Europe.
Mm-hmm. The good part about this is, though, it does give Android users the chance to put other apps on it. Microsoft will be pleased because they can now start developing apps for the Android phone and might be able to get them on there. The challenge here, of course, is that the Google Play Store is a train smash. It's insecure. It's full of rubbish.
You
it's
really
hard to
hate
use.
You hate Android, don't you?
I really do. Yeah. Like, I tried. Wow. I did.
I'm with Seth. I really like my Pixel 3 XL.
Takes great
I bought
pictures.
Some Android
The pictures,
the
images are fantastic.
Yeah.
And have you tried the digital zoom? It's amazing. It really is good. All right. But Greg doesn't use his phone for anything, so he doesn't really need it.
Nah, I mean, like, you know.
And this,
whatever.
This new screen. It's the OLED screen is beautiful.
Yeah, much better.
Yeah.
And it's wireless charging.
I love that. Finally, it's back.
Right.
Yeah.
So there was actually a little bit of that EU settlement that kind of went under the radar a little bit, but it's actually a big deal. And that's that Google used to say to like Samsung or LG or whatever, if you want to use the Google Play Store, which you have to use for Google Maps and like a lot of important apps, you can't put anything else on your phones, on any kind of phones across like your line of stuff.
You can't. Wait a minute. But Samsung does. They have the Samsung versions of many of the Google apps. You're not talking about that.
No, they. I mean, Samsung and LG have their own stores, but there's always the Google.
You have to have all the Google stuff
on every single Samsung device.
You can't sell a non-Google phone.
Right. I mean, an Android non-Google phone.
Right. AOSP, open source.
Now, part of the ruling was that Google can't enforce that. So if somebody wants to put Play Store on the Galaxy, you know, S10s, and they don't want to put them on the low-cost ones or whatever, Samsung can do that now. So that, that actually kind of...
Well, think about Amazon. Amazon sells Android stuff. Yeah. But it's not Google Android stuff. It's de-Googled. They made a phone that was nobody bought because it was de-Googled. Now Android could Amazon. Well, actually, not now because they're not in the EU. But if in the EU anyway, a company could make both. They could make a Fire phone and a Google phone, which was never allowed before.
Right, and you know, in the U.S., Amazon was kind of forced because they sell like Prime special phones. That used to have the Amazon Play Store as the default, you know, app, you know, where you get your apps. And they actually had to revert that to a different setup because Google was saying, look, if this manufacturer does this, we're not going to let them do any Play Store stuff. So had that been the EU in present day, they wouldn't be able to enforce that. But we're in America and we don't have any kind of rule like that.
God bless it. God bless it. It does feel a little bit like Google saying, "All right, well, screw you, EU. We're gonna just charge you." But you know, in a way, their explanation is reasonable. Yeah, you took away some of our revenue opportunities. We got to make it up. The cost.
Yeah, for how long? I mean, it's not like Google's suffering for cash, right?
No,
So it is a desperately greedy move to demand that I want my $40 per phone back.
Well, it's as little as $250. Well, it depends on the country, and it depends on the phone and the resolution of the screen and all that.
It's just one of these situations where companies that are like making vast wads of cash for almost zero effort, and they still want their cash. This is Ebenezer Scrooge right in action. They could give away that and just go, right, whatever, fine. And
they have to make it.
So, Seth, have you noticed, I won't ask Greg because he doesn't use a Pixel 3, but I noticed this when I was playing Pokemon Go in the city, that every time I launched the camera, because I was ostensibly in San Francisco to take pictures to test the Google's camera in the Pixel 3, but I happened to be playing Pokemon Go in between, every time I launched the camera, it would kill Pokemon Go. There's something going on with multitasking.
Yeah, so there's a couple things. One is the, like, for whatever reason, the foreground app is using it's the only the only part of the app that's kind of protected. So if it's not in the foreground, kind of all bets are off. And I think this is a temporary problem. I think Google's going to go back to
it. Is it intentional for battery life? Because, you know, I mean, we've come and gone on this for a long time. Apple didn't allow background tasks at all. You couldn't have a Spotify running in the background. Because they wanted to save battery, because that's a real drain on battery.
If it is, give users an option.
Right.
Like, right. You know, I would rather lose battery than lose what I was working on, basically.
Yeah, it seems to unceremoniously close the background application.
Right.
Yeah. So maybe it's a bug. It's something certainly Google could change. I think people notice it mostly with music apps because you're listening to music in the background.
Right.
And then you launch the camera and the music stops. According, this is from Android Police, they said in our own test, if you have more than 3 to 4 apps running, you'll run out of memory and background apps will be closed. Do you think the problem is that they just didn't, it's a 4 gig phone, which seems like 4 gigs should be plenty.
4 gigs should be enough to keep at least a few apps open. And they compared that to the OnePlus and the, and something else. And
the OnePlus has 6.
6. Yeah.
And there is you can get a Note if you want to spend a lot of money on the Note 9. You can get an 8 gig flavor.
Right.
I think that's more up to Google, and this may be a bad memory management choice.
I agree.
And that they could fix that. I don't think 4 gigs. That seems like an awful. What does the iPhone have? No one knows, but I think it's like 2 gigs.
They went to 3 gigs, and then on the big one, they had.
Nobody knows because Apple never talks about it.
They never talk about it.
You have to take it apart. iFixit has to tell us.
But they also do a better job of managing memory.
Right.
They have the dedicated processors in there for memory management. They have memory expand. We think there's memory expanders on the onboard socks that they've programmed into the ARM chips to make it more viable. And they've also done a lot with their own, with the Xcode stuff to make it efficient. Their memory handlers are better than Android. Because Android is written in Java, you're kind of.
Yes,
screwed, really.
No kidding. Actually, there's a great piece in Anand Tech on the A12 processor and the amazing things that Apple's do. A lot of the things that they don't talk about that are just really smart, especially with
the JavaScript accelerator.
Yeah.
There's a hardware JavaScript accelerator. They've added instructions to the ARM core just to accelerate JavaScript.
And now the iPhone is faster than an iMac in rendering JavaScript somehow.
Mm. Yeah, isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually beating
them. It's not like Intel could have done that. You know, I remember last time I was on the show, I was sort of highlighting the fact that Intel hasn't really advanced following the market. They've gone down a path and sort of tried to drag the market along with them. And this is kind of a hint that that's actually something that we're seeing.
Somebody asked me on the radio show, I'm going to ask you, Greg, should I get an Intel chip or should I be seduced away by the new AMD Ryzen?
I don't care, really.
Doesn't just matter, does it? They're all so fast.
I think, you know, you could argue that this one's better than that one. And, you know, we could go and look at cars and argue over a V6 versus a 4-speed with a turbocharger. And, you know, you buy whatever you buy. But I think the main thing to keep in mind is that you only want to keep it for, I don't know, 2 to 3 years. And then just don't waste too much of your life picking out a phone that's only going to be around for 24 months.
Is the moral of this conversation, or at least the modern era of technology, that it It is the mobile era of technology is mature. Is IoT the next thing? I don't know about consumer IoT, but it seems as though there is a theme running through all of these conversations, and that is that which was once revolutionary and fantastic and really thrilled us maybe 10 years or so ago is it's not necessarily bad. It's just reached an apex, and the lines no longer do the hockey stick of excitement or of sales unless you were reaching the right market. So are we, even with processors, are we at a point where until we hit the next thing, and I won't say quantum with any bit of seriousness, but are we in the next era of computing, or at least at the pinnacle of the mobile era of computing?
Well, I think when you say mobile and you mean phones, yes, I think we're definitely apex.
It's hard to imagine something that you could do that would make everybody jumping up and down, but I think we're going to see wearables, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's
so IoT, right?
Yeah. Well, as wearables IoT? I don't know.
I don't know.
I think it feels like the next. Now, I played with the Magic Leap. I played with the Magic Leap last week, and I think I fell for
it.
No, it's the same stupid. It's so at the time I'm all excited. The same thing happened to me with the Oculus Rift. Oh, this is great!
And the HoloLens 3 years ago.
This is going to change the world. It's so exciting. But then, as I'm thinking about it, it was a fairly anemic experience, and I mean that almost literally. The images are washed out and watery, and it wasn't really, honestly, it's not going to change the world as it stands. Now, I can see a day when you could get something amazing and something that looks like regular glasses, but I don't know when that's going to happen.
Yeah, a solution looking for a problem. A bit like Bitcoin and Ethereum, still a solution looking for a problem.
Hey, but blockchain, man, that's going to change it all.
Oh, jeez. We went the whole show without saying blockchain.
It's all going to be better once we get blockchain. All right, I am going to show you the most exciting technological revolution that has happened this week in a moment. But first, I'm going to tell you what I'm having for dinner. I don't know. I know it's in the fridge. I'm having Blue Apron. Blue Apron is awesome. You know, I get the end of the day. This is a hard day for me. I do the radio show, I do Twit. I'm working hard. I get home around 6 in the evening. I'm starving. I don't want to go shopping. I don't want to do meal planning, but thank God for Blue Apron. Once a week, we get our Blue Apron delivery. You choose, you know, 3 or 4 meals. I get 3 meals in a box. And I know Sunday night, I'm going to cook, and I'm going to cook a Blue Apron meal. Everything I need is there. All the ingredients, exactly the right amounts. If I need 3 tablespoons of soy sauce, there's a little bottle with 3 tablespoons of soy sauce. There's no waste. The recipes are great, and they're easy to follow, and they're just delicious. The best thing about Blue Apron for me is I get new ideas for things I'm going to make down the road. I cook something, or I use an ingredient I've never tried before. Farro, speaking of Greg, Farro. I'd never had Farro before. Not Greg Farro, the other kind, the wheat Farro. I cooked it the other day at Blue Apron. It was amazing. I'm going to buy it from now on. So it broadens your horizons. I really love Blue Apron. Whether you're looking for quick and easy meals or a full culinary cooking experience, Blue Apron lets you choose from a range of recipe options. You go to the website, blueapron.com/twit, and you can choose from the menus. And they have some amazing dishes. Every week, at least 3 recipes are designed with your schedule in mind, where they've done the meal prep for you, they've done the sauces, the spices, and the ingredients, so it's very quick and fast. That's something new, and I love that. Get rid of your grocery list. Let Blue Apron do the meal prep for you as little as 20 minutes from getting home to sitting down, and your family will love it. They have Blue Apron for couples, Blue Apron's for families with kid-friendly ingredients, and the smell, and it's so much better than takeout. Or God, don't go to the Olive Garden. Just no one should ever go to the Olive Garden. Just make something. The house smells amazing. The kids go, "What's for dinner? That smells incredible." Even get them to help. Get them to help. Learn them how to cook. Get out of your cooking rut. Experience the joy of chef-designed recipes, restaurant-quality meals. Better than that, tomato and basil pesto pizza with roasted cauliflower. I can't do these ads because my mouth starts watering every single time. Stir-fried, this sounds so good, stir-fried sweet chili chicken with broccoli and rice. You like steak? How about seared steaks and homemade steak sauce with mashed potatoes and sautéed carrots? Oh, seared beef dumplings and jasmine rice with sesame garlic bok choy salad. Just, oh, it's so wonderful. I love Blue Apron. The other day we cooked, it was so good. It was a fettuccine with shrimp, spicy shrimp. It was a one pot meal. It was easy to cook and it was delicious. Everybody ate it up. The other day, gnocchi and beef. Oh, I can go on and on. Skip meal planning. Get straight to cooking with Blue Apron. I know you're tired at the end of the day. Please don't go to Olive Garden. Check out this week's menu. Get your, or worse, Mickey D's. Check it out. Get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/twit. You're going to love it. blueapron.com/twit. Your first three meals free. It's just a better way to cook. I love it. All right. The big tech reveal. Echo, turn on whisper mode.
Okay.
This is spooky.
I turned on whispered responses.
Echo. Oh, wait a minute. I have to do it. What time is it?
It's 5:09 p.m.
How do you like that? Wait a minute. Let me try that again. Echo, what time is it?
Whoa. I think you just whispered to me. From now on, when you whisper, I will whisper back. You can always say turn off whisper mode.
Echo.
It's 5:09 p.m.
They should have called it Halloween mode.
That's it. That's the best thing that's happened all week to me.
All week. There you go. We could go home. Let's just pack this up.
Let's go home, everybody. We're done.
Just pack it up.
But think about it.
Speaking of, I got to scram. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
We'll talk to you in the future.
He's running off to turn on whisper mode. Dan Patterson, at Dan Patterson on the Twitter. You can tweet him there if you have input into their great hacking series at cbsnews.com/election hacking. Thank you.
Thanks, all.
Echo, I love you.
That's really nice. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Eight adult websites were hacked, exposing intimate user data. Actually, what I got from this article on Ars Technica was how interesting some of these websites are. Wifelovers.com. Are you on wifelovers.com? Uh-oh.
It's amazing these sites have never taken the security seriously to the point where...
They don't care.
Yeah. Just because you think that they would be secure doesn't make them secure.
No. IP addresses connected with the site's user passwords... Protected by a 40-year-old cryptographic scheme. That sounds like maybe a Rot 13 or something. Names.
Using Captain Crunch decoder ring.
Yeah. Names and 1.4 million unique email addresses. Robert Angelini, who owns wifelovers.com and the seven other sites, told Ours yesterday that in 21 years... They've had 21 years, fewer than 107,000 people have posted. So
where did obviously he's not been doing a very good job of managing spam bots.
It's not exactly Ashley Madison, but they were using something called Descrypt, or is it Descrypt? But that was a hash function created in 1979 based on DES.
Wow. And that's been obsolete for a very long period.
Yeah, well, and DES was cracked shortly thereafter. Yeah. Anyway, just want to, if you're on wifelovers.com, you just, you know, I don't know.
You probably aren't using your real email address.
I would hope not.
What did you think, Leo, about the Bloomberg story this week? I'm still all fired up about this
one. All right, we could talk about this one. I think this is still, you know, in fact, I'm sorry Dan's not here because I think this is still a hot topic. And now the latest is that Tim Cook is demanding a retraction. So in case you missed it somehow, 2 weeks ago, Bloomberg Businessweek, and they put this on the cover of their print magazine, declared that Supermicro had been hacked at the factory. I mean, they don't assert that Supermicro knew this was going on, but that small rice-sized chips have been placed on Supermicro motherboards intended for companies like Amazon, Elemental, Apple, the Department of Justice. These motherboards are used to control drones. And the Elemental system, which we use, which is a streaming system, it was discovered apparently by Amazon during their security due diligence before acquiring Elemental, which they have since done. That this chips was on there, what it would do when you booted. The operating system would still secure boot clean. But after the boot, the chip would get in and modify the operating system, phone home. It's believed it was the Chinese military that were doing it. I talked last week to Mark Millian, who writes for Bloomberg Business Week, knows the authors of these articles. He says they're very credible. This story was in the works since the Obama administration for more than 2 years.
See, they're not credible, Leo. They're actually not. They actually have a history of blowing up stories that actually have no foundation in fact.
Well, and this tell is me which stories. I want to, you know, people have been saying this, but I want to see those stories and I want to see what they got wrong because Mark said Jordan NSA Richardson is very, very technical. Okay.
So NSA Heartbleed. So back in 2014, there was a bug in OpenSSL.
OpenSSL, which,
and in theory, the NSA knew about that and they wrote an article claiming that, but that was complete falsehood. And they never resiled from that position. There's another one after that, the author Jordan, what's his name? The Richardson. Author of the original article.
It's Michael Riley and Jordan Richardson. Yeah.
Yeah. And they've done it again in 2016. They boot up a big one. I can't think of the exact one right now because it's getting a bit late. And then they're doing it again in 2018. They're beating up a story that actually isn't true and saying, oh, no, no, we were told by secret magic people while we were eating mushrooms down the back of the building that this is actually true. There's no evidence here. You could certainly make, in my view, this is a story that I could tell you things about possible security breaches and you could run away and tell a story like this. But everybody in my community, like I work in enterprise IT and we actually look for this sort of stuff. And yes, it's all theoretically possible, but it's actually no one's ever seen it in real life. No one's ever seen it.
The Heartbleed story is interesting because it is related in some ways. Michael Riley, who wrote that, was one of the authors on this, on the Supermicro story. Mm-hmm. He said in his article that the NSA knew about Heartbleed and used it.
Yep.
But it's very similar because the reason you're saying it's debunked is because the NSA denied it and the government denied it. There's no knowledge of whether they did or did not. It's the same exact thing, which is that the intelligence agency said, no, we didn't do it. Like, you believe them?
Yes. But more importantly, if they had have taken advantage of it, someone somewhere in the world would have seen that. And there's no signs of it ever being exploited by the NSA.
I think that's not credible. I think that, for instance, the NSA may have used it once in a targeted attack. The NSA collects these not to use them in mass.
I've never seen you go to the toilet, therefore you never go to the toilet. And that would also be true because I've never seen you go to the toilet.
Well, that's what I'm pointing out is that the NSA could very well have known about it. There's no way to know that they know. And you're saying that, well, that we don't know that they ever used it. Isn't it probative? It's exactly what you just said.
It's been comprehensively debunked over the years by any number of government employees who said no.
I don't trust those number of government employees.
But you can't publish articles at this scale claiming secret fairies at the bottom of the garden.
No, but wait a minute. What if you have, and as they did in this case, 17 sources? Yeah, anonymous, but that's normal journalistic practice, right, Seth?
You could also just have chatted to 17 people down the club and claimed them as anonymous sources.
No, first of all, it's not the Daily Mail we're talking
about
here.
And one of the sources, one of the sources said that, hey, you know, I did talk to Bloomberg and I presented a couple hypotheticals, but nowhere did I say that this was happening or whatever.
Well, that was one of them, yeah.
I feel like
there's five of them. Risky Business had a podcast and he interviewed a couple more and they were asked what would this be possible and what would be the possible ways, and they gave them some hypotheticals and they're now being reported as fact in the Bloomberg article.
I kind of feel like this is what's happened.
I don't. And the only reason is you've got a very respectable journalistic enterprise. You've got an editor-in-chief who came from The Economist, who's highly respected, who is intimately involved in this 2 years' worth of reporting and oversaw it. Now, I understand people don't like unknown sources, but when you're talking about national security stories, good luck getting somebody to talk facing a lifetime in jail.
All right. So let me talk about it this way. Like, if I was trying to compromise a server, I would not use a hardware implant. The first thing I would do...
I acknowledge that. And Supermicro especially had tons of firmware flaws. There were all sorts of ways to do this.
And so it's very easy to misinterpret a weakness in the BMC and call it a hardware implant because that would be false, right? The second thing is, even if you had an implant on the board, in which case it would be easily found, And like you would have to, if they were manufactured onto the motherboard, there would be hundreds of thousands of these so-called implants somewhere in the world, and no one can find them.
That's going to ultimately prove the truth or the falsehood of this, because somewhere somebody's got to have a Super Micro motherboard with this chip in it.
And people have been actively looking for these implants for over 5 years, as actively doing so. The second question is, how do you activate the implant? So once you've got an implant sitting in the BMC, how do you activate it? How do you tell it what you want to capture? And then how do you exfiltrate it? Right? You've got to make use of all these things. Quite honestly, doing these things...
But wait a minute. Now, hold on there. Because we know that is possible. From the Snowden revelations, we know the NSA had a modified Ethernet port that was able to do exactly this.
No, what they actually did was modified Cisco routers at the time. They actually got into them and rehacked them. Now, that was back in an era when technology was way less sophisticated. That is in like the mid-2000s or so.
So you're saying you couldn't do this today?
It's incredibly difficult. In theory, it's possible to do it, right? In theory, it's possible to create an implant that would be very hard to detect. However, in reality, you've got to activate the implant, you've got to program it in some way to give you data, and then you've got to exfiltrate. So even if you had a motherboard that had an implant, whether it was in the BMC or in the Ethernet chip, it still doesn't mean that it's actually a weakness or a vulnerability, because we put exfiltration controls. You can't exfiltrate easily, and the implants would be connected to a separate network. That would usually imply that there's an implant in the server, and then you've got to get somebody on the inside to activate it.
You're saying that it would have been obvious, even if this had been there, that they were exfiltrating data, that they were somehow communicating with
exactly, because if the hardware implant was in the BMC, then you would be on the out-of-band network. And when they tried to – we go to a lot of trouble when we built these data centers, so that even if the out-of-band network woke up and started doing something, you would see it, because you watch the out-of-band, because that's the control engine.
However – I got to point out, there's no question at all that these kinds of activities, whether in hardware or software, occur all the time. They occur in the supply chain, and everybody's agreeing that, and they've been going on for at least 10 years in the supply chain, and there's not much protection against that. Well, Bruce Schneier, or Brian Krebs said it, he reported on something similar 10 years ago in the Washington Post.
Yeah. We've seen lots and lots of suggestions of it, but we haven't actually seen too much evidence. There's only been a few. And the IoT ones,
I'm kind of surprised at how credulous you are that government agencies would tell the truth on this.
I suspect that the people who are telling the truth are telling the truth. I think this is a beat up by Bloomberg. I do not believe that they actually have anything. And what they've done is they've taken talking to security experts of what might happen or what could happen. And I've seen, or somebody got drunk and told them a big story, and they've turned it into a beat up. Now, it turns out that Bloomberg journalists actually get paid when they move the market.
Yeah, that is a little bonuses. Unfortunate. Yeah, I think that's a real problem. Yeah.
So it's very difficult to believe that these people have credibility when you know they're getting bonused by making a beat up out of an ordinary story.
Well, we'll see. Tim Cook has called for a retraction, which is something unusual. Apple has never called for a retraction.
Not publicly. They've called for a retraction.
Have you ever experienced anything? I won't put you on the spot, Seth.
I find that extraordinary.
They've
as a CEO of
They've asked you to take down stories, yeah. So they do this privately normally.
Of course.
Yeah, of course they do.
But they've also published, they've done comprehensive reviews internally before the article was published and after the article was published.
Do you think, Seth, that Apple, if this were a true story, that Apple would lie? Because they denied this categorically and now they're asking for a retraction.
I don't know. I kind of feel like they have to tell the truth in this scenario, because the evidence will eventually come out.
It would be very damaging if they did lie about it.
Yeah,
there's no evidence. I don't think there'll ever be any evidence.
Well, we don't know, but I think you might be right.
I think Apple has actually gone through, and double-checked itself a little bit. There's been some time since the story came out and Tim Cook called for the public. And I think he probably went down and said, hey, I'm going to say I want a retraction. You better not, there better not be something here that's going to make me a liar. So, he went down and made sure all of his people were right. And I think the call for a public retraction, something that they haven't really done before, would require them to be 100% sure that they're right.
We've also seen, so just to add to that, AWS has responded saying that this is untrue. The NSA has responded and said it's untrue. We've seen various people who used to work for the NSA at the time that this happened come out and say they were covering this area at the time, and they're saying if this had happened, I would have known about it, and it didn't happen.
And all that to being top said, it off, the Chinese government said it's not true.
Yeah.
Right. So it's actually possible that it's not the Chinese.
And I mean, the other thing that makes me upset here is attribution. It doesn't have to be the Chinese government here. It would be much more plausible that somebody compromised employees at Supermicro to put the implant in.
Well, it wasn't Supermicro. It was at a supplier to Supermicro.
Exactly. Yeah. And it could easily have been the Russians or the NSA themselves if you want to get all.
Well, it was in China. You know, so, I mean, but yeah. I think the real import of the article is that these kinds of things happen all the time.
And wouldn't it be easier to slip like a little code onto some firmware?
Absolutely. And that does happen.
So just to talk about that. So this vulnerability happened in 2015. Since 2015, we have moved into things called secure enclaves. In particular, your iPhone is a key issue here because it actually was one of the first devices to come out in the mainstream with secure enclaves. It's largely linked to the finger ID thing.
And TPM's been around for a while. That's also a secure.
Yeah, so
but I have to say, when this story broke, I talked to somebody in this business. He actually is a big, big supplier of hardware to big, big companies, server farms, and as you know, an expert in this area. He said, "Yeah, it's completely possible, and I believe it happens all the time. It happens though, just as often in the mail. You got a server on its way to the Department of Defense, and it gets interdicted on the way." As it happens anywhere else. And I don't think he's convinced that any, and they do, by the way, he did talk a lot about the things you're talking about, the methods they use to secure these devices, like secure boot and stuff. He said, it's very difficult.
Yeah, SGX and ARM's got its crypto island.
It's very difficult to fully say something is secure. And there's a lot of incentive for nation state actors and others to get this stuff in there. You're going to have to work harder to convince me that this isn't happening.
I think.
You're saying 90% our preventative measures are so successful that this isn't happening.
I think the organizations that are being in question here, they take these very seriously. All of those organizations test the server motherboards, they inspect them, and indeed they do inspect the supply chain and have done since Snowden went public, right? And there are a range of features available to them to use. And most of these cloud companies do use SGX or TXT or, you know, ARM Crypto Island or AMD Secure Processing Functions. They do implement them. Now, in enterprise IT more generally, now back out here in the real world where I live in, none of those secure features are actually used in the real world. The vendors do talk about them and promote the fact that they have these features, but only a very small percentage of their products actually have this secure boot functionality through these trusted enclaves.
You probably missed this, but the United States GAO, the Government Accountability Office, issued a report to the Committee on Armed Services in the Senate this month. Weapons Systems Cybersecurity, DOD, just beginning to grapple with the scale of vulnerabilities. And if you read it, it's a horrific indictment of the security on weapons systems in the United States, which are sitting on public internet in some cases. I mean, it's
that's horrible.
It's horrific. The Department of Defense said DOD faces mounting challenges in protecting its weapon systems from increasingly sophisticated cyber threats. This state is due to the computerized nature of weapons systems, DOD's late start in prioritizing weapon system cybersecurity, and the Department of Defense's nascent understanding of how to develop more secure weapon systems. They are more software-dependent, more networked than ever before, and according to the GAO, completely vulnerable. So I think your confidence in the security of
is
misguided.
Hardware security, my confidence level is that hardware implants is the wrong way to go about this.
There are many ways to go about it, but I think counting on defense,
you could blame it on malware.
Now you're backing down because you implied that
the
defensive measures
the point
were effective.
That the Bloomberg claims are entirely unfeasible and impractical. No one would want to do that. And I believe the whole claims by Business Insider in that specific. Now, if you want to talk about the U.S. Navy running Windows NT4 in the weapons system for a substantial chunk of their their surface ships. Yes.
Please tell me you're
you
kidding.
Do have a vulnerability problem, right?
Yeah.
And the networking hardware that's in there also dates from the early 2000s as well. And the servers, all they actually have 25-year supply agreements with traditional net, IT vendors to supply exactly the same kit for the next 25 years. Vulnerabilities and all, by the way.
Yeah.
So, yes, this is a problem. And it's not just limited to the Navy. I mean, all of the military stuff is often runs on tremendously obsolete hardware.
I mean, if this Bloomberg thing is true, won't there be a motherboard brought forward?
With I would think so, chip? Yeah.
And
so
this,
as yeah. These elementals, just to use the specific ones they start the article with, we used for years, we still do, we use an elemental. Now it's from AWS and we sent the old one back. But I know people, including Alex Lindsay, who has many old pre-Amazon elementals. But does he have the wherewithal to scan the motherboard and find these implants? I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's people the other question.
All he's got to do is tell people that he's got one, and they'll come and have a look.
So email me, and I will get you. I will have Alex get you one of these motherboards if you know how to find this chip. You know, I don't know what it takes to find it. It might take some sophisticated tools, but if you know how to find this chip.
One of the other things that it struck me, just to take this a step further, is if hardware is a security risk. There was an article about 2 or 3 months ago where Apple was having a problem in China. A couple of years ago, so the article was published a couple of months ago, and the problem was 2 or 3 years ago, where people would buy iPhones and then take them outside, disassemble them, take the genuine components out, put third-party components in, and then take them back inside the store. And it was a way of defrauding the repair process, right? And so they would have this supply of genuine Apple components that they would then sell in the spare parts business. And apparently they used to stand outside the store with a bag of and have all these people lined up and paid per phone to take them in to get them repaired. And that's part of the reason that Apple doesn't repair phones anymore is because it needs to have the integrity of the supply chain. And in the latest MacBooks, I believe that Apple is moving to actually lock down the repair inside of those so that if you try to use a non-genuine component, the box will not work. You actually have to have a special app to certify that each – to actually – cross-sign all of the components inside of the boxes. And that's the reaction to this. Now, this is not new. This has been going on for 5 years or more. But part of the reason that we are losing our right to repair is because of the supply chain integrity issue. And if you say to vendors, you have to prevent this, then at the same time, you are also losing your right to repair. So you need to be careful about what you ask for.
Alex probably doesn't care whether he can repair his elemental server. He says he has one made in the spring of 2015.
Yeah.
And he had a little poll. Should I void the warranty and break it open to see if we can find some? Now, I think finding those, by the way, 95% voted yes. We need to know.
Yeah.
There were some interesting replies in here, including Father Robert Ballasaire and so forth on what you would need to do. It's probably non-trivial. Robert said the best thing to do is just put it online and see what kind of traffic you get coming out of it. It'd be a lot easier than finding that chip.
It'd be all he'd have to do is take some high-res photos and publish them.
Yeah.
That's enough. People who know what they're looking for would be able to look at those and start to go, yeah, I know what that chip is. I know what that is. Hang on, what's that?
Yeah.
If it's a chip, and if it is indeed a chip, if it indeed is it not, somebody's put the code inside of a sock or another chip.
Yeah. Who knows? That's the problem. Yeah, it could even be nowadays – the way they make motherboards with layers, it could even be in the motherboard layer, one of the layers of the motherboard, not even visible at all.
Perhaps. I'm not so sure. I'm not an expert in that field. I would expect some high-res photos and tell people to go nuts on them, and certain people would look at it and go, there it is, and they'd nudge the person over there who'd nudge the person over there to say, look at that.
Yeah.
That's how this sort of
last
stuff.
Story. Thank you, Greg. I'm glad you piped up because we've covered over the last few weeks. But I think it's great to hear your point of view on it.
Yeah, I think Bloomberg needs to publish a retraction. I think it's bunk. I think it's a complete beat up, and that Bloomberg has probably lost its position as a platform of record.
Well, that would be a fairly dramatic price to pay. Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen passed away this week at the age of 65, which is awfully young, says I, now in my 60s. He actually, I think it's his third bout with cancer. He had left Microsoft in 1982. He was the guy who woke Bill Gates up in his Harvard dorm room, slapping him around with a popular science article about the MITS Altair computer, saying, Bill, you gotta drop out of Harvard. We gotta write some basic for this program. Bill Gates wrote, I'm heartbroken by the passing of one of my oldest and dearest friends, Paul Allen, from our early days together at Lakeside School through our partnership in the creation of Microsoft to some of our joint philanthropic projects over the year. Paul was a true partner and dear friend. Personal computing would not have existed without him. And of course, he was a great philanthropist, spending many millions of dollars and eventually even agreeing to join Bill Gates and Warren Buffett in their philanthropic pledge in 2010 to give away at least half of his $20 billion fortune. And I guess that is ongoing. I worked for for Paul briefly. He owned Tech TV for about 4 years. Ended up selling it to Comcast, but I only met him once. I don't have much of to say about him, except that he seemed like a very sweet guy and kind of shy. He was kind of kept to himself.
I heard he could play guitar.
And he could rock the hell out of a guitar. Paul Allen, one of the pioneers in the computer industry, probably one that's not well known because of, he left it in the early 80s. But really, somebody, as Bill Gates said, with whom personal computing may not exist. Seth, it was great having you. Thank you for being here. 9 to 5, 9 to 5 Mac, 9 to 5 Google, and electric. All about electric vehicles. You can read his stuff there. Thank you, Seth Weintraub.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Greg Farrow, packetpushers.net. Subscribe today. I think you got some idea what you're going to be getting. Ethereal Mind. And he wasn't even down to the pub earlier.
No. I nearly thought about having a couple of wind-ups, but yeah. I thought that wouldn't be very professional.
Thanks also to Dan Patterson, who had to leave a little bit earlier, but it's great to have all three of you. We do this show every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's, for now anyway, 2200 UTC, although we will be leaving summertime in a couple of weeks, and that'll change it a little bit. You could tune in live at twit.tv/live. You can even join us live if you want to join us in the studio audience. We had a couple of very smart people in the studio audience today, one of whom works for the Google and infrastructure, and one of whom is a PhD in mathematics. Don't show them. They're secret. No names, but Drew and Zachary. It's nice to see you. Thank you. If you want to join them in the audience, do the same. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv and be in Petaluma sometime when we're recording a show. Tickets at twit.tv. You can download copies of everything we do at our website, twit.tv. On-demand versions of this show are available pretty much anywhere you go, including your favorite podcaster. In fact, why don't you subscribe? That way you'll get it automatically the minute it's done. If you want more information about subscribing, go to twit.tv/subscribe or just open up your favorite podcast program and search for This Week in Tech. I think you'll find it. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is amazing. Bye-bye.